This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
You are listening to a special edition PTBN Pop podcast on Star Wars: The Last Jedi. Place to Be Nation Pop. How are you? This is Todd Weber, host of Conversation Comics with Todd Weber. And we are here today to talk to you about a little film called The Last Jedi. We'll be doing a spoiler-free portion as well as an extended spoiler portion here. But this is kind of an instant take podcast featuring members of Place to Be Nation Pop, or as I like to call it, the non HTF contingent of the Place to Be Nation Pop Network. And so I have three distinguished guests with me, starting with the co-host of Geek and Sassy, and this is the decidedly sassy portion of that podcast. This is Miss Jennifer Smith. Jennifer, how are you?
I'm fantastic. Thank you for letting me talk to you guys. And, you know, I don't know what makes me decidedly sassy, but I'll take it.
You're just sassy. You talk back, and you're more sassy than the other half. So
she might disagree with you there.
Also with us, the host of Sellers Points, or the co-host of Sellers Points, Mr. Russell Sellers. Russell, how are you doing, bud?
I am one with the Force, and the Force is with me.
That was last movie, bud. Wrong film.
I can still quote that movie. Thank you very much.
Yeah. I missed that film. It's already been a year. That was a fast year since Rogue One came out.
Wasn't it?
Yeah. And also, the fourth member of our distinguished panel of The Last Jedi reviewers is Mr. Tim Capel, the immortal one, the Cyclops avatar. The other half of Conversation Comics for this 2-year-long cycle that we're doing. Tim, how are you, sir?
I am most excellent, and I'm a little bit surprised to be here, considering how I lag behind the cultural conscience, so to speak, of Place to Be Nation Pop. I don't usually see these movies at the same time as everyone else. I'm more often than not pulling up the rear, so for once, I'm on the front end of things. Thank you for having me.
Well, I'm glad you did it, and there is no podcast that cannot be improved by adding a little Tim Capel to it.
Agreed.
If you get my meaning. Wow. He's kind of like...
So kind of you. Wow.
He makes everything a little bit better. He's kind of like the JR's BBQ sauce of Place to Be Nation Pop. You just put it on, whether it's anything, any kind of meat or fries or fruit or veggies. You put Tim on it.
Veggies.
This also makes Todd...
Don't rush in. Thanks for buttering my buns and not going in dry.
This makes Todd Weber the main event mustard of the group.
Yeah, I do like that main event mustard, even though I left it behind in Orlando. I bought some from JR at his show last year at WrestleMania, and I left it in the apartment for a weekend. But nonetheless, we're here to talk about The Last Jedi. All of us have seen the film. This is Sunday, so the film came out on Friday or Thursday night for some people, some lucky few who are able to see it on that last moment. And so we're going to do a little bit here, our initial reactions, some spoiler-free talk. So in case you have happened upon this by accident, you have plenty of time to avoid being spoiled about Jar Jar's return and other things.
But, okay.
All right, so I'll start with Jenny. Jenny, were you excited to see the film? Did you have any anticipation or any thoughts about what the film was going to be like, and did the film live up to your expectations?
Of course I was excited. I'm a total Star Wars nerd. I'd planned to take my son on Saturday, and then I just decided that I had to see it before that. I couldn't wait, and also, my son is not great at the movies, so I was like, I don't want to be dealing with him and trying to watch this for the first time. So I snuck, and I saw it Friday while he was at school. As far as my expectations, they were high. I loved The Force Awakens. I loved Rogue One, and I just expected to be completely, in the same camp with everybody else and love this movie, but I will say that I was a little bit disappointed.
Well, we'll get to that. Cool. Mm-hmm. But good to know, and certainly noted. Tim, how about you? What was your reaction to The Force Awakens, and how did it temper your expectations, temper your expectations for The Last Jedi?
I have to say I was a little bit underwhelmed by The Force Awakens, but I say that as a person going into Star Wars movies today. If you were to ask, are you excited for this movie, whatever it is, whether it's a continuation of this latest trilogy within the main series of Star Wars, or it's a Star Wars story a la Rogue One, I'm never all that excited for Star Wars these days as an adult, as a now, 34-year-old. I don't know. I'm someone who the original trilogy was extremely important to me growing up as a child. Something I was always very passionate about that I rewatched and revisited many times over and over and over. But I think I got to a place in my life where I was content to sort of put that away. I don't want to say, you put away your childish things, but that was sort of what Star Wars became to me, was something that I could look back on and rewatch as an adult and get that same sort of feeling of childhood nostalgia, but wasn't something that I wanted to carry forward and carry with me into adulthood, even though they kept churning out movies. I always had sort of a detached interest in where the saga went in the future, but I just haven't had the same passion, the same vigor for it. So I'm almost more of a casual fan now of what Star Wars has become and what it is nowadays. Nevertheless, somewhat like Jenny, the zeitgeist will not wait. And much as I did not have a great deal of anticipation going into this film, I don't know, there was a certain kind of palpable buzz in the air where people were talking. There seemed to be, it was different, this compared to The Force Awakens. I felt like I really wanted to get on the ground floor and see what this was all about, love it or hate it. So sure enough, late showing Saturday night, 9:30, I went out to the cinema and made for a very long night, but I was glad I did it, ultimately, and we'll get into that.
Russell, how about you? How hyped were you for The Last Jedi, and was part of your excitement just wanting to see it before anybody spoiled anything for you? Was that kind of a concern for you?
For sure, because I think most of us who have been pay attention to all these things and are spending any time on social media know that folks just could not wait to tell you all about The Last Jedi, whether it be in their spoiler headlines or the pictures they chose to use for their teaser roll-up images. Spoilers abound. So yeah, I was ready to get to this thing. I actually took a day off work on Friday to see the movie at a noon showing in IMAX, and I was glad I chose to do that. Actually, it's kind of a tradition around my office, because my immediate supervisor, who is now the main boss of my division, is actually a huge Star Wars nerd as well. So this was something that he was also on board with. So we both wind up taking the day off and going to see Star Wars together when these new movies come out. And Yeah, I would say, like Jenny, I was a huge fan of The Force Awakens. It tickled my nostalgia button in all the right ways, but also intrigued me with these new characters and this the new possibilities of where this might go. So that combined with some of the most excellent trailers I've ever seen for any movie for The Last Jedi had me fully on board the big old hype train, and I was riding that sumbitch all the way to the end of the line. So, and I'll say that I'm probably going to be the one who's the shameless Star Wars shill on this particular podcast. But
that's all right. That's good. I mean,
however, I do have some things that bugged me about The Last Jedi that I will get into with you guys a little bit later. I'm sure I actually probably share some of your criticisms, honestly. But overall, I was so happy with what I saw in this movie. I actually went to a 10 a.m. showing this morning to see it for a second time.
Wow. So you've seen it twice.
Yes.
Jennifer's seen it twice.
Mm-hmm.
Tim, you saw it just last night?
Just last night, so I'm probably maybe the freshest coming into this.
Yeah, and I... Let me look around the room here. Hang on.
All right.
So I saw it twice. I saw it once with my family yesterday, Saturday morning, in 3D IMAX, and bought the tickets in October. And it's been a tradition. You know, that first Saturday that's out, we try to get the first showing at the local IMAX downtown Sacramento and see it. And it's usually 3D, and that's okay. It doesn't bother me. My kids always appreciate the 3D more. So, but I found myself with a couple of free hours on Friday morning. So I was able to get a single ticket on Fandango and get into there. I was one of the first people in theater, and I guess the theater was only about a third full because it was mostly people like me. Oh, no, my wife heard me. I did see it a second time.
Busted.
Darn it. Busted. It was only six bucks, but I kept the secret as long as I could. Well, Place to Be Nation pop history occurring here. Someone being busted on the air.
In other words, like Jenny, you were screening the film in advance to make sure it was appropriate.
Well, I just wanted to make sure that my kids didn't see anything that they shouldn't see, like someone milking a creature for green/blue milk. Or
that's right.
I think we could all hear in the background.
Man, I am
saying,
deep trouble.
We've got to run in. We've got to run in, folks.
Todd's going to take a chair shot during this one.
Yeah, that was good. The manager ran in and hit me with a cane. I had very high expectations.
Well, somebody stop the match.
Yeah, the referee has called for the bell. I was really excited about seeing Last Jedi because I didn't want to be spoiled on anything. I wanted to see it as soon as I could because I am on social media probably more than I should be, more than any middle-aged man should be involved in social media and the internet. But also, Force Awakens was so much better than I expected. It was kind of like I was so worried that it was going to be not worthy, and seeing it was very fulfilling. So I had faith that The Last Jedi would be something very special as well, or at least a worthy successor to the Star Wars lineage. So, I was very excited. Saw it twice. Saw it once in standard definitions, regular screen, and then once in IMAX. So what do you think? I'm going to start with Russell. Did it meet your expectations or exceed them, or was it lower? Did it come in lower than your expectations? And I think we all know your answer here. So go ahead and tell us why.
Well, I would say that it met my expectations in that I was one of those people that did not buy into any of the fan theories or any of the other like speculation, stuff like that. I don't get into that with Star Wars, mainly because I feel like it takes away from my enjoyment of the films, because it so very rarely turns out to be true. There's no point in getting invested in something that someone not involved with the movies came up with. So I went in basically cold and said, tell me your story and I will see if it entertains me or feels satisfying. And that's what I got out of The Last Jedi, because I didn't go in with, you know, the expectation of some like wild-eyed fan theory that I came up with myself. Now, of course, that's not to say that there weren't things in the movie that missed for me, because there were a couple of narrative points that we'll get into in the spoiler section that I thought really didn't fit unless you were just trying to, you know, force a conflict, I guess, is the way that I would describe it. But for me, this absolutely kind of changed the game a little bit, because where people criticized The Force Awakens for being an aping of A New Hope and Empire Strikes Back, The Last Jedi certainly did not do that. This was unlike any Star Wars movie that I have ever seen. Even Rogue One was not like this, and Rogue One was vastly different from any Star Wars movie that I had ever seen. But I would say that writer and director Rian Johnson really pushed the envelope, for better or worse, and for me, it was largely for the better, because it finally set things in a way that I feel like the future is strong, or potentially strong for the franchise, because now they have something actually truly new to work with.
Yeah, I would agree with that. So much of Force Awakens was just done on that A New Hope template, and in my opinion, a lot of the Last Jedi was kind of taking elements of both Empire and Return of the Jedi and getting them out of the way, getting yep. them following up those themes, those homages, and clearing them out of the way. Because I think Episode 9, nobody has any idea what to expect at this point. But
don't you just love that?
It's a good thing. Absolutely. It's not a bad thing. It's a good thing. Tim, I went with you second last time, so I'm going to go with you second again. How are your expectations met or not met with this film?
It is difficult to talk about this without going into spoilers or specific plot points, but I would say that let's look at it this way. This film, I think, was more stimulating to me intellectually than it was emotionally, which is not what you expect out of a Star Wars film. I think Star Wars connects with most people more on an emotional level, and that has certainly been my experience, again, going back to the original trilogy. But that was not the case with this film, and it definitely surprised me, and I think pleasantly surprised me. And I find myself in sort of the odd position of rather vigorously defending this film against its detractors within the Star Wars fandom. So it's kind of the inverse of The Force Awakens, where you had that sort of critical divide, where the critics were not quite as high on it, I think, as the hardcore fans were. This time around, you have a very strong critical consensus on this film, much more divisive within the actual Star Wars fandom. And I am leaning more with the critics on this one and applauding the film for the things that it did differently and the things that are being criticized. All that said, I think taken as a whole, this film, I mean, it didn't blow me away, but I think it did actually exceed my expectations as the Star Wars fan that I am today as an adult. So that was a little bit surprising to me.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to get into this without breaking down, well, why didn't I like it, or why did I like it so much, without getting into spoilers. But there are a lot of butthurt Star Wars fans about this movie. I don't know that I've ever seen where the critics loved a movie so much and then the fans didn't. But it hasn't seemed to hurt the box office at this point. It came in just under what Force Awakens did in its opening weekend, and that's pretty strong. So I'm not concerned. I know this movie will hit a billion worldwide, just like Force Awakens did, and I honestly feel it's a worthy successor as far as made to the same quality, and it's definitely continuing the thread. It's absolutely worthy to be a Star Wars film. Of course, that means different things to different people when you talk about things like the prequels. So, Jenny, what did you think? And at least as far as comparing the execution of The Last Jedi to your expectations for this film?
Well, I don't think anybody is worried about Star Wars not making money. That's one thing you pretty much don't have to worry about when it comes to this particular franchise. But, and y'all know me. Y'all know me. I'm a fangirl. I love to love this shit. This is what I do. This is what, you know, sci-fi and fantasy and this is like my jam. And I bought tickets with no thought in my mind that I wasn't going to love it. Like, and I didn't subscribe to any fan theories. You know, I wasn't, you know, trying to figure out who Rey's parents were. I just appreciated The Force Awakens for what it did, for being sort of homages to the original trilogy and also doing something a little bit fresher. I could see what they did with that movie. I saw what they did with Rogue One, which was grittier and quote-unquote darker, and I loved that movie as well. So there was just no... It was a shock to me when I was not thrilled when I came out of the theater. I'm not one of those people who have a problem with run times. I'll sit in a good movie for 4 hours if I have to. It doesn't bother me. But I felt every minute of this movie. It felt very long. And it was disappointing. I was shocked. I was honestly shocked at my reaction. That I mind the difference of the film. Like, it feels like a different film. It's not that I mind that. It's just the way that it was different that I mind it, if that makes sense.
I guess when we go specific and journey into the spoiler zone, we can explore that a bit further as far as how it feels different, mm-hmm. why this was such a different film for a Star Wars movie. So, yeah, I'm a mixed bag. I would say it met my expectations, but based on some of the hype I was hearing, I was thinking I was going to have a transcendent film experience, and I didn't quite have that. Although seeing it twice, it was definitely a very different experience each time, which is funny how jam-packed this film was with both plot and script. And things that you are thinking about the first time you see it and that you miss are the first time because you're contemplating what just happened. So it fills in the backstory. I'm going to say that it met my expectations, but just barely. But like Tim, I think I'm kind of in the middle, definitely on the positive side. It's still a very good film, but I had like the same kind of expectation that I had. I'm trying to think of an analog, something I can input. Okay, Marvel movies. You know how the Marvel movies have this standard of excellence. Each film gets a little bit better. So I would say that I had the same kind of level of expectation I had for Guardians 2. I thought that Guardians 2 would be an excellent film and hit all the check marks of what I expected. And Last Jedi, to me, didn't quite do that, but it was still a very good film. And I will still have to kind of keep watching it and letting it kind of settle in my head. It's funny because we judge these films both on how well it's made as a movie and the performances, but we rate the story too. And is the story entertaining? Is the plot entertaining? So we're kind of rating not just the direction of the film and the performances, but the actual writing, the actual plotting of the film, and if it met your expectation. And we have so much looking at the original Star Wars trilogy of 4, 5, and 6, yeah, of thinking, well, they couldn't have done that any better. It's such a tight story. You know, the cuts from groups of characters to groups of characters, and there's the Star Wars tradition of doing that. And does The Last Jedi meet that? And I think it does, overall, but some of it was just didn't quite have the urgency that I would feel in other Star Wars films. And some of it certainly did, of course, had that drama, had that tension, but other stuff felt kind of light and unnecessary or not as scary, I guess it's the word, not as tense, not as dramatic as it could have or should be feeling. So we'll get into more of that when we go into our spoiler zone in a few minutes. So I think the last thing we can do, we can also, let's talk about just, can everybody mention some things they liked about the film in a general sense, and then rank it within the other, or the 10 total Star Wars movies. Can you rank them? We can do that in a spoiler zone, spoiler-free zone here. So I will start with Tim this time. Tim, what were some specific general things you enjoyed about the film that give away nothing? And then where does it sit within the pantheon for you?
Oh, boy. I feel like I'm going to be stealing everyone's thunder here because I think we will be in agreement here that the cinematography was really brilliant. This film, I think, draws a lot more from, for example, Kurosawa, which the original Star Wars, before it was Episode IV, before it was A New Hope, what George Lucas was going for and what he was influenced by, I think it's, in a lot of ways, at least in terms of its visual aesthetic, kind of a throwback to these influences, and all the better for it. I think specifically in terms of, again, not getting into plot specifics or spoilers, but the throne room kind of in those deep red tones, and just the lighting and the optics of the whole thing was really a visual feast. Certainly the score as well. I mean, it's almost a given that you're going to compliment the score of any Star Wars movie. It's kind of sort of beneath commentary at this point, but it did not disappoint in that regard. And there are, you know, some very meta elements to this movie, which is not going to be everybody's bag, but I don't know. I'm just the type of person that, if you've heard me on any of these podcasts, when it comes to any sort of very genre-specific interest, I just eat that shit up. Anything that has that meta aspect, that meta element going for it, I am totally there for. And this was rich in that. So I have to say it was very pleasing to me that it really struck that note on the level of here's the story it's telling and here's the story it's telling about its place in the Star Wars mythos. And on that note, when we get into, you know, rankings of the films, I think it will take a little while to settle, but I would say I definitely liked this more than The Force Awakens and more than any of the prequels. So is it safe to say this is my fourth favorite?
Or better, yeah.
Yeah, fourth favorite Star Wars movie, quite possibly. I don't want to say for certain yet. I only saw the movie last night. So
I know.
It's difficult to definitively make any statements, but that's kind of where I'm at right now. So
and we'll for see. Clarity, let's exclude Rogue One from these rankings just because it's kind of its own deal. Of the Skywalker saga films, so this one's kind of right just on top of the middle. So four out of eight. So the top half. Very good. All right, Russell, your turn, sir. Some specific generalized things that you enjoyed about the film and a ranking within the other seven films.
A specific generalization. Okay.
Sorry.
No, that's okay. It's going to be tough for me to rank it, but I'll try to do it at the end of this. I got to echo everything that that Tim said. The cinematography, which I will definitely be getting into in the spoiler section, because there's a couple of scenes that I wanted to call out, but they would definitely spoil big moments in the movie.
I was trying real hard not to. Yeah.
I think we may be thinking of the same scene, and it's breathtaking in IMAX. And that's something I can say about a lot of this movie, is just that visually, it was just stunning. I don't know that I've ever seen a Star Wars movie that looked this good. So from a visual standpoint, it's got it over just about everything that's ever come before it. And that is saying something, because there have been some great-looking Star Wars movies. The performances are something that I wanted to call out that I can talk about in a kind of general way without spoiling anything, because Mark freaking Hamill, what a performance. He was always good as Luke. I mean, he, you know, defined a lot of our, I think all of our childhoods in a way with his performance as Luke Skywalker, but I think here he took the character in some wildly unexpected directions, but it was all just so well done. I mean, he stands out and brings a level of gravitas that he didn't even have in the original trilogy. And that was something that I very much appreciated. I thought that he was the movie. And I mean, of course the other cast are good. They've all got their high points. I mean, Daisy Ridley was excellent as Rey again. And I appreciated very much the development of Adam Driver's Kylo Ren slash Ben Solo. And they finally gave Poe Dameron some character development for my money. I was a big fan of the direction that they started to go with his characters throughout the movie. There were some disappointing stuff with the cast, but we can talk about that later. The score, I think, Tim, did you mention that? I think you did.
Yes, I the John sort Williams. Of very, very lightly brushed it, yes.
on my first viewing, I mean, it's there. It's an essential element to Star Wars, having that John Williams score. But the second time I watched it in non-IMAX viewing, just a standard viewing, I really paid attention to the sound to see how it was intermixed into the film. And John Williams is just a treasure. The man's music elevates some of this movie to a level that only he could possibly get it to. And even more so than that, there's a moment that I alluded to earlier, a moment in the amazing cinematography where the music and sound drop out completely. Mm-hmm. And you just see it. And it takes a minute for the sound to come back, but when it does, it is just, oh, no matter if it's an IMAX or if it's in standard def, man, it doesn't lose a step. It is just amazing. It's something that you just have to see to believe. So I would highly, highly recommend IMAX viewing for your first time seeing this. So with all that, without getting too deep into plot, I would say the plot definitely got my attention. It did things that were very unexpected, and I very much appreciate it when a movie can genuinely surprise me. And that's something I can say absolutely for The Last Jedi, is that I was entertained and surprised in equal measure. So that's a big piece in the plus column for me. Ranking it, It's still so fresh, so it's difficult.
Yeah.
I mean, Empire Strikes Back is still my favorite Star Wars movie. It has not replaced that. I wouldn't even put it at number two, as much as I enjoy this movie. Return of the Jedi is still my number two Star Wars movie. And I'm going to go controversial and say that I would put Force Awakens above A New Hope.
Wow.
Even though Force Awakens, it's a hot take. Even though Force Awakens owes its entire existence and formatting to A New Hope, I just felt like it was done better. But that's just me. I think I would put The Last Jedi just below A New Hope on that one for me. So there's that, and then it's not even really worth ranking the prequels, folks. They'll just fall in line, put them in whatever order.
Oh, I don't know. I know someone who stands by that that the Revenge of the Sith is like one of the greatest films of all time.
Revenge of the Sith has the greatest lightsaber battle of all time, although I'll save that for later. It's there's a moment that's pretty damn cool. But the lightsaber battle in Revenge of the Sith, yeah, it's awesome. It's breathtakingly great. It's 30 minutes long. That was a bold choice. But as a movie, but I'm so in love with you. Do I have to keep going on how terrible the dialogue and delivery is of that film? And
no!
That too? Dear God, no. Dear God, no. Don't make me watch it again. But
it has unlimited power.
Hey, you can give me Palpatine chewing scenery all day long. Just don't make me sit through Hayden Christensen or Natalie Portman ever again, and we're fine.
Even just kind of the reveal of Palpatine coming into power is so done anticlimactically. There's so many things. There's good moments.
We're not here to review Revenge of the Sith, boys.
Fair enough, but like I said, the new trilogy so far is popping me in a big bad way, and it's still going to take a little time for me to settle on where The Last Jedi falls into my overall ranking. But right now, it's having just watched also The Force Awakens this weekend, I didn't enjoy it as much as I enjoyed The Force Awakens, but it was still a tremendous movie for me. And is right there with like Force Awakens, New Hope, and then The Last Jedi. As of right now, who knows if that changes later after I've had a few more viewings, but I feel pretty comfortable putting it like that.
Yeah. All right, Jenny, you go, and then I will wrap this up. Go ahead.
I will agree with everything that you guys have said about the cinematography, the score, and you stole my words, Russell. I was going to say Mark freaking Hamill. And I know, because he was good. Although he did do one thing that I did not enjoy at all, but that's okay. We'll talk about that later. I really like what the part of this that did sell me was the Kylo Ren and Rey relationship. I loved their quote unquote scenes together and how it was portrayed. I think they have amazing chemistry. And I kind of ship them a little bit. As much as I like Finn, I do kind of ship them a little bit now. And as far as ranking goes, all right. Well, it might be easier to go from the bottom on this one, but it always is going to be Empire, Jedi. Then I'm going to go Force Awakens. New Hope, Sith.
Mm-hmm.
Probably Last Jedi. So, like, just below Sith for me.
So fifth out of eight films.
Yeah.
Yeah, I kind of expect this film to settle in that 4 or 5 slot between the eight. Okay, so...
So wait, am I the highest on this movie based on our rankings then?
Well, it's because you didn't have the highest fandom of Star Wars coming into it, like Russell did or I did, so I think that's probably the difference.
I mean, I did, but then I didn't.
Right.
You know?
Not everyone has ranked these, to be fair.
Well, go for it, man.
Rude.
All right, so Charles, I'll go ahead and start with my rankings, and then maybe I'll kind of explain some of the things I liked. So Empire Strikes Back is one of the greatest films ever made, and it's obviously number one. A New Hope is still my number two, but only just barely over The Force Awakens, which is only just barely over The Last Jedi. And then I have Return of the Jedi, and then in descending order I have Sith, and Phantom Menace and Attack of the Clones is actually the worst. So is that what it's called, Attack of the Clones?
Yes.
Yeah, I'm going to actually agree with that ranking of the prequels.
Yeah, me too.
I think that's correct.
I mean, there's good things about Menace that no bad Jake, whatever his name, performance, Jake Lloyd performance can overdo.
The pod bad writing. Is awesome.
Pod race is great, and the Darth Maul fight is fantastic, yes. And the Duel of the Fates is the only thing musically I remember from any of those three films.
I know, yeah.
And it's a tremendous scene and score. John Williams, all the way.
Yeah, and what an achievement for John Williams to have scored all eight of these to this point and have memorable things from all of them. It's intertwined with the entire Star Wars saga. You cannot have one without the other. So Force Awakens, I think I keep comparing this film, Last Jedi, to Force Awakens, just because they have so much of the same DNA. You know, they're working out of the same toolbox.
Well, it's fair. It's a direct sequel.
Mm-hmm. And I can't think of too many things in The Force Awakens that I would change. I would say, oh, they could have done that better. That was unnecessary. But with The Last Jedi, there are at least a handful or a small handful of them for me that I could say, oh, I wish they hadn't done that. I wish that could be changed. On Force Awakens, I wish that Leia had hugged Chewbacca before she hugged Rey when they came back and found out that Han was dead. But that's just a minor fan thing, and that might be tying into, you know, your fan headcanon, if you will. That we're going to talk a lot more. Russell talked about it a bit with why some of the audience rankings are so low. People had their own theories, and when your own theory, you know, isn't proved to be right, do you hate the film because you're that narcissistic? I don't know. I guess because I have to look at that too, because I had certain expectations for. Well, this question is going to be answered. And Star Wars does have this tradition of setting up questions that are due to be answered. Empire Strikes Back told Luke that Vader was his dad. Spoiler alert. And then we had to wait until Jedi to get that confirmed. We had Empire set up that Yoda said, no, there's another hope. We had to wait for that to be confirmed. We didn't hear in Return of the Jedi, no, there is no other hope. There is nobody. That was just me pulling your leg. So
that was just us making this up as we go.
Yes, which that's what our fear is that's the fear that the directors are just allowed to do that. And I don't think that's the case. I think there's collaboration and expectations. So, excuse me, I got my ranking done. I will say that music was excellent, but it's always excellent. Cinematography was pretty new. We saw some things in Star Wars that we had never seen before. Artfully shot. Even, I don't know, is it Rian or Rian Johnson, if he has his own style yet, but it was definitely different in visual tone to The Force Awakens. I love seeing, spoiler alert, slight, that we went to some new locations. Of course, we go to new locations in every Star Wars movie, so that's not really a spoiler. I will say that performances were, for the most part, very strong. I will compare Carrie Fisher's performance. She was given a lot more to do here, and she was a lot more credible and a lot less distracting in this one. For the most part, if we look at her performance as a whole compared to when she showed up in The Force Awakens and her dentures kind of squeaked a little bit.
How dare you, sir?
Ed, but I will say that it didn't bother me as much in this one. I don't know. She was just her performance was that much better.
To spoil things a little bit for our second half, she has probably both one of the best scenes in the movie, and she definitely has the absolute worst scene in the movie.
We'll talk about that. But she did have a lot more to work with. That's not
absolutely.
You know, with Han Solo being dead going into this one, we knew that we were going to get a lot of Luke. We were going to get a lot of Leia. CGI-wise, I would say it was mostly spectacular. You could definitely tell that when they're using practical sets, it's so much better than CGI.
Yes.
Very much so, yes.
really bugged me was there was a fight kind of at the end of the second act of the film in a hangar that was may or may not have been blowing up or flaming. That just kind of seemed like a video game level. But the rest of the film, the effects were tremendous for me. Space effects, as always, are great. They definitely are kind of they really like this effect when the ships show up out of hyperdrive. They're showing that a lot more. The pop, pop, pop.
Look I at love them. That part.
Yeah.
Yes.
Love it.
The popping out of hyperspace looks so good, and it's really cool how Rian Johnson added the what this subtle shake effect to it, which is something that I hadn't seen in any of these movies before. And I will say that certain CGI characters did not make me feel like I was trapped in the Uncanny Valley.
Yes.
Specifically Snoke. Mm-hmm. And you see it in the trailers, but when you see it on screen, wow, they did a good job with him. There are moments where I completely forget that I'm looking at a CGI character. It felt like they did practical effects, but then whenever you read about the movie, you're like, no, this is all CG. This is a mocap performance done brilliantly by Andy Serkis. But wow, just mind-blowingly good effect there.
So, yeah, I would agree as far as the quality, especially of that particular mocap CGI performance. Some of the other ones, a lot of people have been going back and watching the prequels because they've been on TNT and on demand, and oh my goodness, when you see Samuel L. Jackson talking to a CGI creature or something like that, it's so appallingly bad. And, you know, nobody... There's a rewatchability to Force Awakens and the original trilogy, and I hope and I expect that there will be to this one too, just because it's so packed with stuff. This particular film had so much plot, so much happening, not layers necessarily, but just it kept going places, and it was the longest Star Wars movie, and it was, I know Jen thought it was too long and she felt every minute of it, but others have not necessarily felt it. The second time I saw it, it kind of flew by for me, which is crazy. So I think this one will be very rewatchable in the grand scheme of things. Even though there are scenes we won't like, overall there will be scenes that we're going to keep seeing and deriving things from, pulling things from. So that's about it for this first half, I think, as far as spoiler-free. We have done a darn good job of not revealing anything these past 45 minutes or so. Does anybody else have something they want to say about the spoiler-free portion of this film? Good film. Everybody liked it except for Jenny.
I didn't hate it.
I didn't get the impression that Jenny just hated the movie or anything. I think she liked it. I didn't feel – I'm with you, Todd. The movie flew by for me both times that I saw it. Never felt like I was sitting there for 2.5 hours, though I do feel like part of the movie could have been tightened up a little bit if they'd really thought about some of their scenes. But what I'd like us to each do is to maybe give the movie a score out of 5. Just to wrap up this section of it before we get into heavy spoiler territory.
But you're not the host. So I vetoed that.
I prefer letter grades.
No.
How about
score out
stars?
Of 5, absolutely. Yeah. Good idea.
Tim wants to go the cinema score route, which is actually, that is something I'm glad that you said it that way, Tim, because the only place where the audience score doesn't match up with the critic score is over on Rotten Tomatoes, which has gotten plenty of coverage. But if you head over to IMDb, which uses a similar metric, it actually has more votes there than it does at the Rotten Tomatoes version right now, and they're sitting at a 7.9 out of 10. Mm-hmm. And the cinema score, which is, of course, the scientifically accurate way of polling audience members who've seen the movie, it got an A cinema score. So the word of mouth is actually stronger than what the loud voices on Twitter and over at Rotten Tomatoes might suggest that it is. So I'm wondering how accurate it really is and how much of that might just be people who are rating the movie over and over and over again, which you can do on both Rotten Tomatoes and IMDb.
Oh, that's bullshit. Oh my God. Okay.
You can create other accounts, and there's no limit to the number of times you rate, and you also don't have to have seen the movie to rate it. So that's...
Well, Star Wars fans would never do that, though. I mean,
oh,
they
sure.
have integrity.
They wouldn't. I'm sure that they wouldn't. But I'm going to go with the cinema score version as the actual fan reaction. I'm sure. And yes, I'd realize that there are people out there who legitimately have gripes with this movie, and some of those gripes are absolutely legit. But as we've alluded to, there are a lot of people out there complaining over some really stupid things, and it's a lot of it has to do with their own headcanon not coming true.
Bombs can't fall in space, Russell. This movie gets an F.
Yep, that's silly shit like that. But
hashtag
anyway,
physics.
If physics bothered them, they'd never been a Star Wars fan in the first place.
I guess explosions don't make sounds either.
No.
Yeah. If we were going to get into the physics of it, nobody would have been a Star Wars fan ever. But
this movie gets an F, clearly.
There aren't such things as like 7 foot tall, you know, like growly bear creatures either.
The hell you say?
And teddy bears can't fight the Empire. That's just nuts.
All right. You're on some slippery slopes right here.
I know. I just wanted to pop you for a second, Todd. Hashtag Ewoks are awesome. And
okay.
Score out of five, please.
4 out of 5. I'm going whole numbers. I'm not doing the point stuff. Just four. A score of 4 out of 5 for me for Last Jedi.
Jennifer.
3 out of 5.
Timothy.
3.5 out of 5.
Add no decimals.
All right. Well, 4 out of 5 then. We'll round
up. 3 out of 5 as well. So. Yeah, I know. I forced myself. If you're going to do decimals, you might as well do a 10 scale. I sound kind of nerdy here. I'm sorry.
A little bit.
I would give it a B+ as a letter grade.
My son gave it 9 out of 10 stars.
Really?
Yes.
Fantastic.
Mm-hmm.
Excellent. Yeah, my oldest son, 10 out of 10.
Wow.
My youngest son said it was fine. So.
Said it was fine. Very good. Jenny,
said it was funny.
Said it was funny. Okay. Well, there's that. Well, there's that, which we can get into.
Yeah.
And Jenny, I would agree with you that I'm not bothered by the length of movies more often than not. I know that's a very common kind of criticism with movies of this nature, and I'm kind of unfazed by it for the most part. But this did feel long, even for as much as it had going on, as much as was packed into this. It did kind of feel long to me, too, so I'm with you on that.
All right. Well, I'll take it.
Yeah, I'll disqualify myself from that discussion just because the first time I saw it, I had a time deadline, and I assumed that it was going to be the standard. Of course, I could have looked up how long the film was. I assumed it would be the standard two hours long to two hours and 10 minutes or so, and it was much longer than that, and so I didn't actually see the final 15 minutes or so the first time. I had to see that.
Oh,
at
wow.
The second showing. So it was definitely a different feeling. And the second showing was much, much quicker to me.
I felt so bad for you when
you
told us that you had to leave. I was like, left it the best part of the movie. Oh, no.
Yeah, nobody spoiled anything too bad for me. So that was good.
Yes, very good.
So, all right, so let's tie this up, and we will get to a wonderful commercial break here on the Place to Be Nation Networks, where you'll hear from my friends Kevin and JT and Chad, and they will tell you all about the great shows we have on our feeds here on Place to Be Nation. And we'll come back on the other side of that with some spoiler talk, where we actually will talk about specific plot points, characters, script lines, everything. And we'll do some speculation for episode 9. So stick around. We'll be right back.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
Hey, pro wrestling announcer Kevin Kelly here. I want to make sure you are all subscribed to all the great feeds here at Place to Be Nation. It's really easy to do. Just head to iTunes or your preferred podcatcher app today and search and subscribe to the Place to Be Nation wrestling feed, which, of course, includes the full archives of the Kevin Kelly Show, the Place to Be Nation pod feed, and the Pro Wrestling Only feed. Subscribe, listen, and then rate us and leave feedback today. And be sure to give Justin your true thoughts. I mean, don't hold back. After all, he is kind of a jerk. Just listen to Scott.
Place to Be Nation's JT Rizzero and Chad Campbell here. We want to let you know that we have a ton of great podcasts available to you on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and PlayStation.com, and we offer those to you on three great feeds. On the Place to Be Nation wrestling feed, we bring you the Mothership, the original Place to Be podcast, as well as Main Event, Lucha Afterground, and our monthly pay-per-view reaction shows, as well as the Our Vantage Point podcast and Jeff Learns Wrestling. In addition to these full-length shows, we also deliver quick-hit pod blasts on topics old and new.
Over on the Pro Wrestling Only feed, we dive deep inside the wrestling business with a stacked army of experts leading the way. The feed features potpourri shows such as This Week in Wrestling, Greetings from Allentown, Psychology is Dead, Puro Potpourri, Stacy and Elliot's Bogus Journey, and the Military Industrial Suplex. We also have shows that focus intently on certain topics like Letters from Center Stage, Space City, an NWA Classics On Demand adventure, Through the Years, Strong Style History, Strong Style Story, and Mount Olympus. Plus, the feed has the full archives of legendary shows like Titans of Wrestling, Where the Big Boys Play, Letters from Kayfabe, and much more. And on our popular Place to Be Nation Pop podcast feed, we offer such great shows as the Glenn Butler Podcast Hour Spectacular, Rank and File, PTBN Dadcast, Go Home in a Box, NBA Team, and Lucha Undead, as well as a veritable podcast heaven for comics fans with the Hard-Traveling Fanboys, Sellers Points, Todd Weber's Conversation, Geek and Sassy, and Imaginary Stories podcasts.
You can find all of these current shows plus archives of our past podcasts, including the Kevin Kelly Show, as well by subscribing to all of our feeds on iTunes. And while there, be sure to rate and leave feedback as well. All of these shows plus others available on PlayStation.com, where we cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus in-depth stretch projects and more. Be sure to support our site by using PlayStation.com/Amazon when shopping online, and download our free PTB Vintage Vault Refresh ebooks via the links on our site. We also want to thank our friends at Bonehead's Wing Bar in West Warwick, Rhode Island, and Fall River, Massachusetts, thehistoryofwrestling.com, and Scott Keith's Blog of Doom. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr as well. PlayStation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
We're back here on The Last Jedi, Place to Be Nation Pop Review Show. I'm here joined by my friends Jennifer Smith, Tim Capel, Russell Sellers, and Nick Duke, who is here all along in the first half. Before we rejoin the section of the show where we talk about actual spoiler events and why we liked particular points of the film, let's go ahead and ask each one, just a lightning round, each one of our panelists, what their earliest Star Wars memory is. Russell, you're first. Go ahead. Your earliest Star Wars memory, sir.
My earliest Star Wars memory is, this is going to be kind of odd, but the first Star Wars movie I ever saw was Return of the Jedi. So that was when I was just like maybe 5 or 6, and it was the one that I guess I had most readily available to me because my parents had recorded Empire Strikes Back and Return of the Jedi off of HBO. So I was curious about it. My mom and dad felt comfortable letting me watch that one, I guess, first, because it included little teddy bears fighting the Empire. And that also was the origin of my love for Ewoks, which has endured to this day. But, yeah, that was my first.
Excellent, kind of. Nicholas Duke, your first Star Wars memory.
So my aunt and uncle used to own the local mom and pop video store back in our little small town back when those were still a thing. And the rule back then was, even at a young age, I was probably like 3 or 4, every time we went in, we got free rentals because, you know, we were in the family and whatnot. I could pick up pretty much anything with a PG rating or below and be allowed to rent it without any real questions. Only if it was like PG-13 did I have to like sell my mom on it. And so after I blew through pretty much all the kids' movies, I just randomly started picking stuff off the shelves. And I don't remember which one it was, but I know I grabbed one of the Star Wars movies and then came back and grabbed the other two. I was so young that I really don't remember which film it was, but I know that was how I was first exposed. It's literally been a part of my life as long as I've had like long-term memories, put it that way.
Did the mom and pop video shop also have Navy SEALs?
Of course it had Navy SEALs. All right. It also had dental school.
Yes.
Did it have Top Secret?
No, but it did have Happy Scrappy Hero Pup.
Yes.
Very good. Happy Scrappy. Remember them big
Sadly, it did not have Come On Eileen.
And there goes our E rating. Tim, Star Wars.
That's actually the Dexy's Midnight Runners biopic, actually.
Yes, so, it was. Absolutely. It was kind of the behind the music of them and their one song. Did you know that Hard Traveling Fanboys still has an E rating to this day?
An explicit rating. Okay.
No. That's right. That's true. I thought E for everybody. Never mind.
No. So, God, no. Please don't do that. I'm not going to be responsible for the defiling of a generation. And by a generation, I mean like Jenny's one kid.
The kids in the backseat.
I already defiled him. Don't worry. Wait. Yeah. Never mind.
Well, that's inappropriate. I'm going to tell DHR.
So Jenny, since speaking of defiling, what was your first Star Wars memory in your lifetime?
Okay. It's hard to remember, but I feel like they used to show it on like TNT or TBS all the time.
USA had the broadcast rights for the longest time. TNT and TBS is a fairly recent thing.
Okay, well, I don't know. It was definitely on TV. I don't remember us having a VHS of it or anything, but I definitely remember watching it with commercials. That's what I remember. And it must have been Empire, because I remember Luke just saying, no! It's probably why I love that one the best.
Tim, your first Star Wars memory.
Yeah, I think it was on the same VHS recording as Bimbo Bowlers of Boston that my parents kept growing. No, much like Russell, same situation where it was just taped off of HBO. It was funny. Jedi was the first Star Wars film I saw. It came out the year I was born. My grandma had like the second half of the movie recorded on VHS, and my dad had the first half of the movie. So between the two of them, I had seen the whole movie. That was the first one I'd seen, and I think the second one was Empire, which my grandma had taped in its entirety again off HBO. So it was just one of those things that I grew up and. When I say I watched these movies every day, I literally watched it every day. The same VHS tape that is completely worn out that I still have. I wonder if it hasn't completely disintegrated by this point.
We put so much, I don't know, emphasis or so much value on those old VHS tapes in the day. You know, put labels on them and – I kept them clean, kept them safe, and now they're all in landfills somewhere.
Right.
I still have some old wrestling videotapes, I think. I think I have like my Dean Malenko compilation tape and stuff like that. Malenko in Japan. But for the most part, all my VHS are long, long gone. I don't even have a VCR. Why do I have VHS tapes? I don't know.
I've still got one. I don't know if it works, but a lot of memories wrapped up in these things.
I still have a VCR because it's the only place I can watch my taped Chris Benoit tribute episode of Raw that will never be shown again in any way, shape, form, or fashion.
Yeah, it was only aired once. Yep. The date on that? I think it was June something, 2007.
Yep.
And I was in Hawaii and I saw that. It was pretty profound. And then, oh,
Just kidding.
What's your bugle noise, Tim?
What's that?
You got to do the Benoit bugle now.
Yeah, you have to slip that. Yeah, I'll have to grab that off the soundboard for you.
But so I have no easy transition from Chris Benoit to back to Star Wars. But my first memory, I think, was I was in kindergarten and I saw A New Hope in the theater, and I remember the applause when Han Solo and the Millennium Falcon came back and shot Darth Vader's ship out of the way when Luke was doing his bombing run. So that was my first memory. I can remember that distinct moment, but from then on, it's just been part of the tapestry of my life. The Star Wars figures, the Star Wars movies, the cereals, the shirts. I have Star Wars clothing, underpants, all kinds of things. Mm-hmm. It's just.
Did you see all of them in the theater?
I have seen every single Star Wars film in the theater, yeah. Okay. And in 1980/81, I had a bus pass in Murray, Utah, and I was able to go to their little dollar theater and watch Empire Strikes Back over and over. There were weekends where I would see it two or three different times the same weekend. It was in that theater for 6 months from my recollection.
Wow.
So, yeah, I've seen them all in the theater. Most of them, well, the original trilogy I saw before most of you were born, if I recall, if I'm doing the math right. Who was born here after 1984?
All of us?
I was born in 82.
Me too.
Okay. Oh, where am I? 80. Russell, there you go.
83.
So, yeah, but, you know, you probably didn't see, you might have seen it on re-release in the later 80s. They did do that once in a while where they would.
Well, and they did I saw the special editions.
Right, re-release. In the late 90s, 96,
yeah, 97. I didn't see any of the originals until 97, and even then they weren't the original editions because that was the first edit.
And they even got me on the 3D re-release of Episode 1 because the promise was that if it did well, they would do all the other 3D versions. So I plunked down money to go see Episode 1 again, not because I wanted to see Episode 1, but because I wanted to see the rest of the films up-converted and re-released into theaters. And, of course, that never wound up happening.
Well, how much better was The Phantom Menace in 3D?
Not much. But they did, for that particular re-release, polish up some of the CGI so it didn't look quite so 1998.
I was rewatching Phantom Menace with my kids last week, and boy, the CGI is bad.
Yeah, yeah, it is.
Yeah.
Nobody's looking at the same thing. We did talk about in our spoiler-free section how much better the CGI in this film was compared to previous Star Wars efforts. I mean, it's the technology, just it's better and better. There was only one time throughout the film that the CGI took me out of the movie, and that was, spoiler alert, now that we are in the spoiler zone, I'm not going to say spoilers anymore, we're there, was the hangar fight between Finn and Phasma. It just kind of seemed like a video game level, all the things going on in the background, like a Mortal Kombat fight or something like that. But CGI was so good on this film for the most part. Yeah.
I can kind of agree with that. That moment didn't take me out of the movie other than it being incredibly too short. And Captain Phasma once again kind of getting not her due, I guess, is the way I could
saw
say
her
that.
Eye. Yeah, you did get to see things bounce off of her, so there was an actual justification for the chrome armor.
Yeah, the chrome armor did finally get shown as being pretty badass, but if the comments from Rian Johnson are to be believed that she is the South Park Kenny of this series, then it's very possible she'll be back in 9. It's one of those things that if she comes back in 9, I'm going to totally buy it. Just because I want to see if she's actually going to get her due or if they're just going to keep using her as this level of cannon fodder.
Well, I've kind of looked at her as the Boba Fett of the new trilogy. That's kind of where I've been going with it. Like, you know, she's a visually stunning character, but we haven't really been given any reason to care about her as much as some people do. And it's kind of like, I kind of view her as the Boba Fett analog of this new trilogy. And so, you know, now that seemingly, I mean, granted, I guess it's possible, like you said, that she'll pop up in 9, but now that seemingly her story has come to a close, it kind of really brings home that Boba Fett parallel in my mind anyway.
It does, and I can go with it either way. If she stays dead, hey, fine, then this is how her story ends. It's not going to bug me too much, but I would like that fight at, with her and Finn to have gone on a little bit longer, and for her to have like really whooped his ass a little. But that's just my personal take. The only CG part of the movie, to Todd's point, that took me out of it was the damn horse cats.
Yes.
That part took me right out of the movie. It was the only part where I was like, yep, this uncanny valley is deep and wide. So I did not dig the writing of the horse cats. The stampede of them was so obviously CGI that no matter IMAX or standard edition, I was very well aware that I was looking at CG characters the entire time. And yeah, it was the only it was the only time CGI was distracting to me.
Would we all agree that that was the least necessary scene in the film?
Yes.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Least necessary.
Oh my gosh.
I mean, there were bad scenes in the film or scenes we wish we could change things, but you could cut and I liked the Rose character. We're going to talk more about her, obviously, throughout this section, but for her to say now it's worth it when she takes the saddle off and that, no, it wasn't. You guys are trying to save the lives of the Rebel Alliance here or the Resistance here, and to get off on this side trek that just
totally,
you know,
could have freed the horse cats without riding them.
I mean, not to say you can only care about one thing at the same time. I mean, yes, we can have multiple whatever social concerns in this movie, in this franchise, fine. But that was definitely the definition of it drags in the middle. That whole sequence in this movie was just like, that's where I felt the runtime. That's where the movie definitely started to lose me. And I was like, all right, let's pick it up here. And this damn movie better get me back because this shit is tedious. And this is really trying my patience.
And so, you know, it didn't start out that way. It was largely fine to begin with. It wasn't until Rose started getting on her high horse, if you will, that things kind of rode off in the wrong direction.
Yeah, it kind of depends on what you're talking about the sequence. If you're talking about the entire Canto Bight excursion, I can't necessarily agree with that because I thought the casino scene was kind of visually stunning and very evocative of the cantina, even though, I know they've already had their cantina equivalent in The Force Awakens, but with Maz Kanata's castle and whatnot. But this was kind of Rian Johnson's take on the casino, on the cantina scene, and I dug it for that reason. Dug all the Benicio Del Toro stuff there that also took place on Canto Bight. But yeah, I can agree if we're looking at it specifically from the standpoint of the, I don't even remember what they were called, but we'll call them horse cats if that's the terminology you guys want to use. Specifically from that standpoint, yeah, pretty, I mean, didn't really serve a purpose in terms of, you could have driven home what you wanted to say about Rose as a character, because that was the only character really served by that in a lot of, in numerous better ways than doing it in that particular way.
I feel like they almost wrote that whole thing backwards, said we need to have a betrayal, we need to have some kind of explanation for why, and we'll talk about the plot hole of the fleet evacuating and the Laura Dern character, Hodor, is it Hodor? I want to say Hodor, but that's the show.
Hodor. Vice Admiral Hodor.
Vice Admiral, yes, the hero of the Battle of such
Middle
and such
Age
that
Psylocke.
We've never heard of. But I felt like they almost like wrote that backwards. Like they had to have this betrayal scene. They had to have some kind of explanation for that to happen. And so they had to have their code breaker. And so they had to write this scene in, and they had to do. I just felt that that was so unnecessary and so extraneous. Although it did introduce to the kids that gave us one of the best scenes of the film later in the movie.
I'll agree with that. I like the kids that they introduced there, and I think that that's actually a big tease for episode 9. Mm-hmm. Personally, thinking that that's the direction they're going, and if so, I'm very cool with that. Lots of potential there, but I'm kind of with Nick on the cantina feel of it because I feel like every Star Wars movie has that. Not to call it a trope because I don't want to put a negative spin on that because I actually feel like a Star Wars movie is kind of incomplete without one. And very much like the design of this this new world, and the plot element that it introduces, which is something that Star Wars doesn't have a lot of, and that's moral ambiguity. Because you have this planet of gamblers who have made their money off of war profiteering. They're weapons manufacturers and sellers. So at one point, they steal, DJ, who is Benicio Del Toro's character, helps Rose and Finn escape on a ship.
AKA Stuttering Gambit. Can we call him Stuttering Gambit? Mm-hmm.
You can refer to him as that. I'm with her.
We can call him whatever you like, Tim, if it means he'll play Gambit instead of fucking Channing Tatum.
Hey, I'm for it.
I'm for it.
But I love the reveal when Finn has this like very black and white view of the First Order and the Resistance as like bad guys and good guys. And then Benicio Del Toro's character reveals to him that, oh, this weapons manufacturer has been selling weapons to both sides. Like, both sides come to the same people to buy their weapons. So, to be truly free, don't pledge allegiance to either.
That is what he said, but that's also like saying, well, this political party that rips people off is no different than this other political party that You know what I'm saying? It's felt like a false equivalency. I mean, the First Order enslaves and murders people and you know, terrorizes systems, and yet what are the Resistance supposed to do?
It enslaves and murders some people. Like, you know, if you're one of the preferred people, if you're one of the, you know, the lucky chosen few, the First Order probably sounds like a great sell, man. Like, you know, it's not – I think the point was to not present – a version of events where we were only seeing the side of people who were being oppressed. That doesn't mean the First Order isn't completely wrong, but like there's a little bit more ambiguity to it there than black and white, and I think that was the point.
Yeah, it was just another layer of moral ambiguity in the film. It wasn't the only one, because certainly there is a much bigger one that I think has shocked a few fans who weren't expecting it. And that involved Luke Skywalker. And I don't know when you guys want to get into that, but that was probably the biggest shift, I think, a tonal shift for this series, at least in terms of how I think about it. And honestly, I was like totally on board with it. But
well, so can you be specific? I mean, we're throwing out the format sheet here, ladies and gentlemen.
Okay.
We're just going to be free flowing. Go for it.
I'll get specific on it. It's we learn the origin of Kylo Ren, and for a lot of people, we've always assumed that he just turned to the dark side because of Snoke's influence. Like it was all Snoke. And we learn in this movie that what actually happened was Luke sensed the darkness in him and went to his little hut or whatever at their Jedi temple to kind of get inside his head while he's sleeping. And when he sees the darkness in him and the potential of what he could become, it scared him, and Luke has his green lightsaber there. He pops it on and is kind of like resolved in his head. He's going to kill Ben Solo, but it leaves him just as quickly as it hit him. It was just a moment of fear, and when he came to his senses, he didn't strike. He stood there feeling ashamed of himself. Unfortunately for him, Ben wakes up and sees him standing there with his lightsaber on. Ben reaches out, grabs his, and the fight is on from there, and that was the moment that Ben Solo fully embraced the dark side. And Luke blames himself for that, but in my mind, that was, you know, the moment where we see that Luke, even though he chose the light over the darkness at the end of Return of the Jedi, his struggle with it was not over. And Luke's turn to the dark side was never about anger. It was about fear, or a fear was something that he hadn't really felt a lot of in his time, but he saw, you know, the potential of another Vader rising up right in front of him, and it freaked him out. But the greatest way that this was presented to me, at least in my view, is that they told this story three different ways. they told it from Luke's perspective, where he left out the part about how he was confronting Ben with a lightsaber and just made it seem like Ben straight up turned on him. And then when Kylo Ren tells the story, the way he saw it was Luke was just murderous and ready to take him out, you know, without hesitation. And if he, and that his turn to the dark side was total self-defense. But then there's the truth of it where they're both wrong, and yet both right at the same time. So it, it introduces that moral ambiguity to both Luke and Kylo Ren. So I found it way easier to sympathize, with Ben Solo's point of view, because if, you know, looking at it from his perspective, that's probably exactly how he saw it. But as the movie went on, we started to see that he has truly given in to the dark side, and it has warped him. Even though Ben Solo is still in there somewhere, the longer he stays like this, the less of him that's going to remain.
And Russell, not to trample your point, because I do want to get back to Luke in this specific instance of this moment of weakness that you called out, but this is the moral ambiguity here. This is kind of a recurring motif in the film, where we see it play out in that sequence, but we also see it play out with the whole exchange between what are we calling her, Holdo and Poe Dameron.
Yes,
where it's basically this terrible tragedy, essentially, of characters misreading one another's intentions, where Holdo basically is intending for the best here and keeping her plan very close to her vest, and it is a good plan, but because she refuses to trust anyone and will not share that plan with Poe or with anyone, essentially, from what we are given to understand, her intentions are completely misread, and
yes.
He acts in a fashion that is basically mutinous and borderline treasonous.
Go ahead.
But I sympathized with Poe on that, because on my second watch, it truly grabbed me, the point that you guys made when we were discussing the film earlier, that if Holdo had just shared her plan to begin with, all of that would have been avoided.
And they wouldn't have been betrayed, and they wouldn't have had it spoiled by Nisha DJ giving that info.
And she might not have died as a result.
And that is true. That is true. But at the same time, Poe is the one, and I agree with that completely, but Poe is the one that basically held up their entire operation, saying, hey, give Finn and Rose a chance here. They've got this decoder, and we just need to buy them some time. And we saw how badly that plan went. Like, if they had proceeded with the plan as designed and just gotten the hell out of there, not waited on Finn and Rose to execute their plan, not stalled, it arguably would have gone much better for the resistance. But because they insisted on stalling, because he held them up, it all went to shit.
There is one other thing to consider there, and it's something that they couldn't possibly know until the end of the movie. The idea was to get to this mineral planet, Krait, and to hold up in this abandoned rebel base and send a message out to their allies in the Outer Rim, where the remnants of the resistance still were. Well, they do that, and unfortunately, no one is coming. Right. So, essentially, even if they had... even if Holdo had told them the plan, they had followed that, which if Holdo had told them the plan, it also would have saved Finn and Rose the trouble of ever leaving, and there would have been no Benicio del Toro in the movie at all, because they would never have left. They would have just said, okay, well, that's a good plan. We'll just stick with that. Unfortunately for them, they would have been stuck on Krait with no one coming to help them anyway. Now, they wouldn't have had the First Order like banging their door down, maybe, but they would have all been together, and maybe Rey would have shown up and gotten them back together. But then again, we would have had a pretty straightforward and kind of boring movie if we had gone that route, and we wouldn't have gotten the single most amazing cinematography shot in, I think, Star Wars history.
Yeah.
With Holdo staying behind on the main freighter and using it as a battering ram through the First Order fleet by like turning the ship towards it and going to light speed. And when all the sound drops out of that scene and you just see the flash of light just like streak through all of those ships, all the air, like I could feel the air in the theater both times I saw it just drain away. Like everybody's breath was taken. And yeah. when Same the sound thing. Kicks back in, everybody was in awe of it. Like, yep. holy shit, what did we just see?
Did everybody have similar reactions in their theaters for that yes. scene where just people kind of, whoa.
Yeah.
Yeah, both
Some
times.
People clapping.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. Yeah. There were cheers, absolutely. And even though Holdo had been a really like testy character, I think all of us were not high on her, that was a hell of a hero moment. Sacrificing herself that way to save as many people as she could was a way of bringing her back around and saying, okay, well, she wasn't all bad.
So, well, and the thing is, the Poe Dameron, his kind of hubris echoes Luke's in a way where,
yes,
you know, Luke was distrustful of Ben Solo, and because of that distrust, he really should have had a yellow lightsaber instead of a green lightsaber, right? It was fear that was his undoing. Where Poe, I figured you would appreciate that. At the beginning of the movie, Poe basically sacrifices, I don't know how many people,
well, the whole fleet. Yeah,
the whole fucking fleet to take out this one, granted, very important, what was it, scout of the First
Dreadnought.
Order.
It was
Dreadnought.
The
Dreadnought. Yes,
the Dreadnought ship.
Turned out to not even be their biggest ship.
Turned out yeah. not even to be their biggest ship. It's not a Star Destroyer or anything, so like, what's the point, right? But his hubris kind of echoes Luke in that he gets demoted after that, so Holdo kind of has no reason to trust him, especially granted that they know they can track them when they're in warp, right?
Which that's the thing. The second time I watched the movie, this is kind of the way I looked at it from the Holdo perspective. So they know that they have that the First Order has determined their location after a hyperspace jump. The mm-hmm. only character in the film specifically state, hey, they're simply using the same form of tracking they would have used anyway, just in a different fashion, is Rose. She's the one who goes, okay, the simplest explanation is probably the most likely one.
Occam's razor.
From a command perspective, you don't know if they're being tracked or if somebody on board is potentially feeding them that location. So you don't know if there is a mole within your order, and thus you want to keep your plans a little bit closer to the vest. You want to basically shrink the circle of command at that point. So if I'm exactly. Holdo, knowing what just happened, no, I'm not going to tell Poe, you know, every step of my plan. I'm not going to let anybody in on it because
especially this
you
guy
have
just
no idea how they're
fucked up and got demoted. Yeah. You know, yeah.
Well, especially since Poe just had them sacrifice all of their bombers to take out one ship. If that could put in a leadership mind that this guy could possibly have just wasted all of our resources on purpose.
Right, I'm looking at
one purpose, or he's just some asshole.
I'm not going to tell anyone because the fewer people that know, the less of a liability it is, and thus the greater chance for success. I didn't have an issue with her like not telling people the plan because, you know, having been around people, you know, military settings a few times in my professional career, you know, you're not going out and openly briefing the foot soldiers on, well, this is exactly what we're going to do from a high strategic level. That's not the way things work.
Go ahead.
I was going to say that's exactly the point that I was getting at. That Holdo struck me as the type that says, "I am in charge. I am your commanding officer. I will tell you when I'm good and damn well ready to tell you." And you follow orders, and that's how the military hierarchy works. Of course, Poe Dameron has proven that he has few issues with that.
I like that, and it makes a lot of sense to me. But if they hadn't spent the rest of the movie just over explaining all of their plans over and over again. All of the expository dialogue freaking took me out of the movie every time. Every single character was all the time telling me what was happening in the movie. And it was driving me insane. So,
like who? I'm looking for an example.
Like,
there was a character who was pure exposition, and it was the kind of like the lieutenant, the rebel lieutenant with the big nose lady.
Oh, yeah, that lady.
Yeah. Yeah. Every line she said was an expository line.
She had to read those ultra-complicated clear glass map models that they're in every Star Wars movie.
Well, Rose and Finn did the same thing. You know, it was just like constantly like updating us where they are in their own little story. Like, Their whole little thing was just a constant, like, telling us what was happening. It was just, and then at the end, she's like, well, we've sent out the signal and they've gotten it, but nobody's coming. That means nobody's coming. Like, that's all, you don't have to explain all that. All you could just, like, say, nobody's coming. You don't have to say, like, we sent the signal out. Like, obviously you did that. And there was another, a really glaring one. When the codebreaker guy is using his magic razor blades to get them out of places and into places, he's like, "I'm going to slip this in, and then we'll slip them through the shields." And it's like, you don't have to explain any of that. All you have to do is show the monitor. Then they show the monitor where the little shield blips, and then the guy looks at it, and then they slip through. Like, it just kept taking me out of it over and over again.
That part didn't bother me at all.
Yeah, it didn't bug me. I kind of like, well, that's how these systems work.
Yeah, we've heard about, if you've read a lot of, or not read, but seen or experienced anything in Star Wars fashion outside the actual movies, slicing has been something we've heard about for a long time. And I think this is the first time we've actually seen it performed on screen. So that was kind of a cool moment for me, as opposed to like frustrating, I guess.
So
I think that in trying to create the existential fuck up that they did with very deliberately with Haldo and Poe and their whole conflict, that it did sort of undercut some of the just dramatic tension and forward momentum of the movie that sort of had to be covered by just exposition as Jenny is saying. I can see that as well.
One part, I will say that the exposition, I can notice it. I noticed it more on my second viewing. So, Jenny, I'm kind of there with you on like certain characters, especially Finn and Rose. Dear God.
My God. It was so bad.
They were not written well in this movie. The actors both, I thought, took what they were given and worked it as best they could.
Yeah.
But the writing did not serve them the way that it should have. But... speaking of characters that have like the odd moments or moments that could potentially have been annoying, but wound up actually being really kind of great for me, General Hux.
Yeah.
Someone who
a little bit Spaceballs-esque.
Wait a minute.
A little bit Richard Spencer there.
Hold on, before you start saying anything.
Uh-huh.
I'm not saying
Well, we're just getting it in because we know we got a 5-minute rant coming, so we're trying to get our reactions up front.
Oh, fair
enough. Guy got hit a lot.
Exactly. That's what I loved about it. He was hit verbally and physically quite a bit during his pontificating, and that's what made it fun.
See, I was rather
every time
be scared
he was on screen. I was glad to not be really scared of General Hux so much. I wanted Kylo Ren to slap him around like a little bitch. And when that moment finally came, it was as satisfying as I could have hoped for it to be. And I guess we'll get to that part in a second. But the opening joke with him and Poe Dameron, when Poe shows absolutely like zero respect to this dude and is just not moved by his pontificating, I was completely sold on it and thought it was a great opener.
And see, that's the one General Hux moment in the movie where I was like, eh. You know, I don't know. Like, I got what they were going for. They were trying to subvert expectations by you're expecting to open with this overly tense scene, and instead you get a joke right up front. But I thought the joke went on a beat too long for my taste.
Yeah, it felt a little bit like Han Solo-esque But they just let it linger a little bit.
Yeah, a few seconds too long on that one.
Right.
Well, it worked on me, and most of Poe's stuff actually worked on me much better this film than it did in The Force Awakens.
Because he actually had a character.
He's
barely in Force Awakens. He's the character in a coma for Force Awakens, where Leia and Finn trade places in The Last Jedi.
And Rose at the end.
And Rose at the end of the film. But that was one of the highlights of the movie for me is the development of Poe's character. I actually felt like I connected with him finally. I mean, it might not work for everybody, but it finally hit for me.
Would you be surprised if he were to be more in a leadership position in episode 9 after this?
Not at all. I'm expecting him, especially with Holdo's last line to Leia about Poe.
Like that.
When Poe is unconscious after his attempted mutiny and they're loading him on the transport, Holdo was like, you know, he's kind of reckless, but I like him. And Leia was like, you know what? Me too. And that's, if the time jump that I theorize is going to happen, and for episode 9, I think that after this, Poe will have learned some very valuable lessons and will be probably the main leadership person for the Resistance going forward.
I hope he's learned some lessons, because I thought he was frankly kind of a shithead in this movie.
I tend to agree with that.
He really did not work for me in this movie at all. And the thing is, I don't know if that was intentional or not. I think certain aspects and certain scenes were intentional, just for the kind of ironic contrast that they were trying to create within this film versus other Star Wars films, which I'm sure we'll get to. But by and large, I thought he was kind of a douche. And I did not have that impression of him coming out of The Force Awakens. I didn't have much of an impression of him at all after that movie. But this one, I'm like, I don't really like this guy. And I'm not sure if the movie wants me to like him or not. So,
Did you think he changed enough at the end? So it sounds like you don't think he had enough of an arc or where his character developed at the end, where he's the one who pulls back, who lives to fight another day, which was kind of, I think, was part, to me, the point, was that he learned about that aspect of things from Leia and Hodel and changed. That was his arc to me. And you didn't see that way?
I guess I'm not convinced that he completed his arc. Maybe on second viewing of this film, you know, looking out for that, you know, from the outset, I might be more convinced, but I didn't get the impression that he had really completed his arc at the end of this film.
He is, to me, he's still on the hero's journey. Like, he maybe really just started his hero's journey in this movie, where we, you know, didn't get to see much of him in Force Awakens. And it's maybe kind of at the expense of Finn's a little bit, who feels like his has been put on pause for a second. And that's, you know, that's where I feel like we leave those two characters. But when it comes to a character whose hero's journey took a big leap forward, can we talk about Rey?
Yes.
Because
mm-hmm. Yeah, let's talk about that
because,
part of it.
Wow. If there's a part of this movie I think that most of us will agree on, her arc with Luke and with Kylo Ren is this movie.
Yes.
That's the reason you're going to go watch this film, because their story is absolutely tremendous. Rey, and we do get some answers about her. I think the most controversial one for folks is we find out who Rey's parents are, and that they turned out to be absolutely no one was so satisfying to me. I was like, this is the inverse of Luke. She is the inverted version of him, where they seem to come from similar backgrounds. They're both very force sensitive. Luke's excuse is because he's the child of Anakin Skywalker, arguably the most powerful Jedi who ever lived. And Rey's is just because.
Yeah.
It proves that a powerful Jedi can come from anywhere. A hero can come from anywhere. And that was the point of Rey's character all along, and that they are going that route with it instead of trying to force some unnecessary connection to previous characters is so damn refreshing. Bold choice. Great choice.
I think that's the overall theme to me of the film, is that anybody can be a hero, the rebellion, or anybody can be a rebel hero, so to speak, showing with the kids at the end and how they're trying to be the spark that inspires anyone.
Yes.
And so I would agree with that on the Rey aspect. Do you think there was disinformation put out by Lucasfilm, or rumors floated, or was that just people's headcanon and theories that got out?
That was people's headcanon. By the time Force Awakens was out for a month, I think I read somewhere earlier there was already fan theory videos out there that had upwards of like 500,000 views, like a month after release, because people I think part of the problem is they were conditioned by the prequels. Like, Lucas created the prequels where everything had a tie back to the original trilogy. So when we had a sequel trilogy, we were preconditioned to the fact that, like, everything that existed was going to have a tie back to the original trilogy. And that sometimes that's just not the case. It can't be the case if you're going to continue to make movies past this, which they totally are, by the way. There's no way this thing ends with episode 9. That is the biggest I've ever heard in my life. So
it's not Disney.
Rian Johnson is getting his own trilogy. We know it's going.
Right, but that it's not going to be part of the saga. Like, it's not going to be not going to be episodic. I am saying, like, there will be an episode 10, 11, 12, 13. Like, there will be episodic Star Wars movies being made when we are, like, 60, or when Todd is 90, whichever.
It's a Star Wars movie every year, right? That's the model now.
Well, it depends on what you believe. There are reports out there that annualized model comes to an end after episode 9, and that they intend on taking a break and kind of starving the market a little bit intentionally to build up demand for the next batch of films. Plus,
they'll take a year off.
Yeah, something like that. But there's also the rumor out there that I've read that one of the things they may do to prolong the life of the film series is, after episode 9 is released, take about 3 to 4 years and focus on television, which also serves the purpose of building up the rumored Disney streaming service. Like, you dump a Star Wars live-action show on there, and people are going to pay for it just to watch a Star Wars live-action television show. Or at least I will. I don't know about anybody else. But
they've got my money.
Yeah, the whole Rey thing, I'm convinced – the Rey thing and the Snoke thing, which I'm sure we'll talk about, I am 100% convinced that, like, all of that was – purely fan-driven, where we all convinced ourselves there had to be some great grand reveal to everything, and we divided ourselves into camps behind our particular theories, and when you do that, there's no way you're going to please everyone if you pick one, because there were so many theories out there that somebody was going to be right. You know, there was no way to surprise everyone other than this. Like, I feel like this had kind of been talked about by some people, that this was a possibility, but I don't think anybody actually thought they would do it. That's my point. And I think it wound up really working.
The film because your personal fanfic didn't come true is mind-boggling to me.
I completely agree.
It is insane.
Like, you got to understand that, you know, thematically in the film, we kind of get the impression, based on her taking of the books and Luke saying that he's not going to be the last Jedi, that there is going to be a something of a resurrection of the Jedi Order. What form that takes is yet to be determined. But we got to remember, the Jedi Order as we know it wasn't all, you know, all the Skywalker cousins as throughout the galaxy as the Jedi. You know, I mean, there are other families out there. There are other races of people who have this power. It's not just about the Skywalkers. And yes, I know that, like, people will make the argument, well, when Lucas first conceived it, it was the Skywalker family saga. Lucas ain't around anymore. It doesn't matter what Lucas conceived. Like, Mark Hamill has openly talked about the fact that George Lucas had a treatment for 7, 8, and 9 that had been around for years that was completely different than what we're doing here. You know? So, I mean, it's one of those things where if the franchise is going to succeed long term, but continue to thrive long term, you're not going to be able to be so beholden to the formula that was set with the prequels and the original trilogy. And to me, you know, the Rey reveal is just the first step in kind of deviating from that a little bit.
We and also got other, think
the
of
other
something.
Step of that is to subvert a certain other formula that Star Wars has been notorious for, and that's always telling us that when it comes to the Sith, it's a master and an apprentice, and we always hear that the apprentice is supposed to replace the master, and it never happens. In this movie, Kylo Ren force cuts Snoke in half.
Right.
In the most glorious fashion I have ever seen and could have imagined.
Got a big applause in my theater.
And same in mine. Both viewings, everybody was so shocked, and I was right there with them in my first viewing. It hit me like a ton of bricks. I was like, oh my god, I can't believe that this just happened. Did Kylo Ren just turn from the dark side? And then when he didn't, when he kills Snoke, but stays on the side of the dark side, I was just blown away. I was like, somebody had the balls to do this, and it is fantastic.
I felt kind of like it was not unlike Triple H at WrestleMania 15.
Oh, his fake heel turn? His fake face turn?
Yes. Yes, Tim got it. Tim got it.
Yes.
You know, where you think he's going one way, and then he ends up, no, this is all my trajectory. did anybody feel that was telegraphed at all, the Snoke, murdering Snoke?
I telegraphed in what respect?
Where you see the lightsaber wiggle just
yeah,
a little
see,
bit.
The thing about that is when they told you it was happening, but they didn't telegraph it any time before that in the movie. I would never have guessed that that's where they were headed.
Because his script, the way he said, is slay your true enemy, that kind of thing. I'm like, I think it's very deliberate. Yep, it happened.
I'm spelling it out.
I thought in that throne room where they're having that dramatic confrontation and just wring that of as much tension as possible throughout that scene, and you're like, okay, what's going to happen next? And I'm like, it's not going to be what you expect. It can't be, because they wouldn't be lingering on it for so long. I thought he was going to kill himself. I thought he was going to activate his lightsaber, you know, right through the chest, kill himself. Like, if they were going to go for the shocking, subvert expectations kind of moment, that's what I thought they were going to do. But it was like, oh, wait a minute, this is heading in a totally different direction. So, I mean, yeah, it was like, it went for the shock, but not the one that I had sort of, you know, would have put money on, I guess.
I liked the moment, and I was glad that they did it, but on my second watch, I started having all these questions about, like, the powers. Okay, so Snoke was using his powers to deceive Rey and Kylo to make Rey lead him to Luke. So, like, they didn't know that they were being manipulated by him. Okay, so that makes you think that Snoke has more power than Kylo, right? So then Kylo all of a sudden has this power to hide a part of himself and make the big kill. Like,
well, also Snoke was using part of his, I mean, his concentration was on keeping Rey in place for the big sacrificial moment.
Okay, so that
was, and probably also trying to suppress her from wiggling the lightsaber. Because when I first saw the lightsaber wiggle, I was like, all right, Rey's gonna call it to her hand. You're gonna get the big Rey and Kylo lightsaber battle that kind of echoes back to Return of the Jedi, where they duel as Snoke sits on the throne and watches and kind of like cackles as everything comes to fruition, you know, in the way that he designed, was what I was anticipating. And then when it didn't go that way, I kind of took it as Snoke lost focus for like the briefest of moments, and in that moment Kylo took advantage of the opportunity that had been presented to him.
That, and finally, Rey said it herself that he underestimated Ben, and I think he totally did. But also, in his manipulation of Rey and Kylo, he was definitely using Kylo's own abilities to augment that force projection, because as Kylo himself says, that there was no way Rey was doing the projection because the strain of it would kill her.
Right.
And it would take, I think that would have been true of Snoke as well. If Snoke had tried it, it would have killed him, because as powerful as he was, I don't think he was as powerful as advertised, and I think that this also kind of illustrated that.
Yeah, I liked how Rey kept calling him Ben the whole time. That's I'm gonna. She's only, and it was such a callback to ROTJ that you just got those vibes watching. That I love that Johnson gave his homages to both Empire and Nick and I were talking today, both Empire and Return of the Jedi in the same film. So much that it clears the plate for episode 9, which we'll talk about going through. But that particular moment, I had such a deja vu with the throne room sequence in Return of the Jedi and how I know there's still good in you, Ben. And then he turned and then he put the twist where he said, no, join me and we'll rule together.
Yeah.
Which
was also a Return of the Jedi callback.
Yes, it was. Yeah. Yeah.
How about that? It was an Empire
callback, really. It was join me and together we will overthrow the Emperor kind of thing.
Right.
And it was that was another part of that that meta commentary you were talking about, Tim. The whole letting go of the past, like let go of the First Order, let go of the Resistance, let it all go and forge something completely new. But of course, in Kylo Ren's mind, that meant like a new like dark side rule of he and Rey, and whatever shape that was going to take.
Neo-fascism, we can say it.
Yeah, it would totally. I kind of wanted her to do it.
I'm just saying. I kind of wanted her to do it.
Did anyone else see Kylo and Luke as different kind of audience surrogates, or am I reading too much into that?
Being I saw Kylo definitely that way with the. You're not part of our story. You don't have to matter. This is a new thing. I mean, he was kept saying, the past doesn't matter. The past is dead. We're moving on. He said it so many times, it's impossible to not be hit by that sledgehammer Johnson.
At the same time, he's insisting on he wants to start something new, but he's being like this shitty and entitled kind of asshole saying that she's not part of the story, we're going to do something different, and yet
falling
he's
back
just talking about doing the Empire Part 3, I guess, if the First Order is Empire Part 2. It's like he's really not advocating anything different. He just thinks he is, you know?
Yeah, that's part of his character arc, I think, and it's another meta-commentary on those types of things. So I looked at Rey and Kylo as the two opposing views of Star Wars itself. You have one audience that wants to move on from Skywalker and the Kenobis and Palpatines and all that and move into something completely unrelated, who, you know, a type of fandom that doesn't respect the past or doesn't want to have anything to do with it and just wants to move on. And then you have the others, like the side that Rey represents, which are like beholden to the past, almost like fully obsessed with it, which is represented by her looking for her parents, both literally and metaphorically, as Kylo calls her out for looking for her parents, first in Han Solo and then in Luke Skywalker.
Hero because she grows.
Yeah, she grows more than he does, but the ultimate end of this, I feel like, has to be a joining of these two things, like an embrace of that unknown, an embrace of that future that can be scary, but also knowing that you're only going to get to that future by fully respecting and understanding where you've been. And I feel like their battle, their ultimate battle, which has to be part of Episode 9, needs to be that kind of on that emotional level. I think it needs to be a physical representation of that that melding of that kind of ultimate, I guess, realization of where this all needs to wind up.
I would love it. I would love that. And then you have Luke as just the bitter old man.
I want him as a Force ghost, haunting. Yes. Haunting Kylo Ren for all his days, which he hinted heavily at the end of this movie. So I guess
see you around, kid.
See you around, kid, yeah. Which is a great line. And I guess that's where we are now because we can talk about this was the last movie that Luke Skywalker will appear as a physical person, because he dies at the end of this one.
And this is the third ever what I'd call an ascension, where a Jedi just kind of vaporizes and disappears. We had Obi-Wan, Yoda, and now Luke. And, you know, they're Force hosts. We hopefully will see... I'd love to see an Obi-Wan, as played by Ewan McGregor, Force Ghost, but
yes.
Who would he advise? He'd only advise Luke, and Luke's gone. So, you know, I think this would have been the movie to do it. But the Yoda reveal was one of my top five moments, I'd say, for the film.
Absolutely.
Yoda coming in, and we all got fooled by the books where Yoda said, Rey already has all the knowledge she needs. Because she literally had the books. I love that.
Yes. I was like, what the fuck are y'all talking about?
I noticed it in my second viewing. The books are on the Millennium Falcon.
Yep.
I completely missed that part until we got talking about it.
So as soon as you have the scene with Rey and Luke, and she offers him the lightsaber for the last time, and he again refuses to take it, the next time we see Rey, she's on the Falcon. And as that, like, the opening shot of that scene is the drawer, she closes it and her face comes into profile, and you don't actually see what's in the drawer. And then later on, when all the refugees are on board the Falcon near the end of the film, somebody opens the drawer to take something out of it, and next to whatever they pick up are all the books in the drawer.
Okay.
It was so Ray put all the drawer.
Yeah. You really have to be looking for it. I love that somebody already caught that, which is
cool. It was a great moment. Like I totally missed it the first time too, but seeing the books there, I was like, that's what she did when she left Luke sitting there, because I think she knew what he was going to do, or like what he would do when she left. And like, she was like, oh, well, if you've given up on starting the Jedi Order, I haven't. So I guess, you know, that feeds into the other idea that in episode 9, we may see Rey attempting to get, you know, a new Jedi Order together to combat the First Order.
Yes, but page-turners, they are not.
Page-turners, they are not. Great line from Yoda. And how great was it to see the actual puppet Yoda used instead of a CI Yoda? And Frank Oz's performance was just right on. The whole theater popped for Yoda both times for me. And it's a moving moment in that movie.
Yeah, it's such another callback to Empire, where he had Yoda chastising Luke all the time and hitting him with the stick and being one step ahead. And so I liked that quite a bit. It felt true, and I my heart melted the first time when I realized what was happening and how it was just a callback to that same kind of scenes between them in Empire.
Plus, it's somewhat important to have that little moment of him tapping Luke on the head with the cane and Luke actually feeling it, to set the precedent that, yes, the Force can be used to manifest physical objects across time and space.
Well, can we
as
talk
though
about,
that came up later.
Can we talk about the island for a minute? Like,
what about it?
Like the dark hole of the dark side in the island where it falls into, and then, you know, that whole sequence was just a little off-putting.
Kind of like Luke in the tree.
Yeah, it's just
Empire?
Luke in the cave. In the cave in Empire.
I don't know.
Yeah, it's just the homage. Like, these films, you know, even though it definitely did its own thing, it still had a little bit of that Force Awakens syndrome of it felt the need to recreate some of the major moments from the films it was taking inspiration from. And this was just Rey's moment in the cave. Like, nothing on the level of, you know, seeing her own head inside Vader's mask. Mm-hmm. But, you know, for Luke, the entire point of his journey was Vader. He was consumed by Vader because Vader has killed his father, whereas Rey was consumed with, like, her purpose and her place in the world. And so, you know, she is shown, much like Luke seeing himself in Vader, that really, you know, she is her own purpose rather than her parents being her purpose.
Yep.
So I actually liked that, the parallelism between that and the scene in Empire.
Well, what
and
about
the scene was done really well. It was a trippy as hell. And visually, as Jenny said, like, it's visually off-putting, but it's in a way that I kind of gravitated to because it was just so different.
It was kind of like Harry Potter-ish to me. Like, it felt more like Harry Potter to me than Star Wars. But what about?
Yeah, I don't get that though, because it was like it's very similar to the Empire scene, you know. So it is.
What about the creatures on the island?
It's also pretty incoherent until you understand that her parents aren't anybody, so she's not going in here to confront an external threat as
right.
Luke did. Like you said, Nick, she's seeing herself, and it feels extremely pointless until that revelation
gets clarified later. What were you going to say about the creatures, Jenny?
I just wonder what you guys' takes on the creatures were. The blue green milk creature, the Borgs.
I'm a creature guy. Like, I think part of the entire appeal of Star Wars is off the wall locales, interesting creature designs. Like, the weirder and more out there, and the more different things you can throw at me in terms of in kind of create this like visual cornucopia of different, you know, stunning images, the more I'm for it. And to me, like, large scale animatronics and puppetry are part of the reason Force Awakens had a certain charm that the prequels never had. And so, like, adding in the blue milk creature, I don't even know what he's called. It doesn't matter what he's called. Like, it was just cool. Like, it's a cool little nod. I mean, seeing them, seeing the Porg, seeing the nuns, seeing the crystal foxes, seeing, again, that entire casino scene. Like, just all that stuff just adds so much to me in terms of the aesthetic and kind of the feel of what I want a Star Wars movie to have.
I'm in full agreement with that. The only thing I was balking at was Luke pushing the milk right out of his teat and then taking a big swig of it every time, man. I'm like, pasteurized.
Listen, man, he's been there a long time. It's not like he's got a pasteurization machine hanging out there. He sunk the X-Wing. He's kind of roughing it. So you got to do what you got to do to stay alive.
It's not that he drank the milk. It's the look that he gives before he does it.
Yeah, it is.
It's such a defiant.
I was like, oh God, it's warm, isn't it?
Ugh.
I mean, that's off-putting to me. I mean, the scene with the porch that really got me, and maybe it's Todd, you're going to hate this, so just cover your ears.
La, la, la.
The scene when Chewie is about to chow down on what I imagine.
That's easily the best port moment.
I'm sure it was his third or fourth by that point, because there were several on a spit on the fire. And all the porgs are standing around just looking horrified and so sad, and like they're trying to convince him not to do it. I'm just... You got me. I'm not heartless. I'm not soulless. That kind of tugged at my old heartstrings a little bit. I was awing right along with the rest of the crowd. But he didn't.
He growled at him. He was like, fuck y'all.
And that was what made the scene work, is that he didn't succumb to the onslaught of adorable.
Yes.
But he carried on anyway.
The porgs in the Millennium Falcon later were great to me. And I didn't feel like the porgs were overdone. That was something that some people have complained about online, and that some people were worried about going into the movie, but I actually thought they were in the movie just the right amount.
Yeah.
It wasn't overdone. It wasn't too much. It wasn't too little. Right where they needed to be. That said, give me a crystalline fox over a porg any day, because those things were pretty awesome.
Yeah, those were visually stunning. I think it'd be kind of cool to see Chewie keep that one porg as kind of like his own personal wood stuff in Episode 9. That would be kind of cool.
Yes, I need Chewie to have a porg with him at all times now, because that was just too good. And I still haven't. I'm still wondering if he was keeping them around as pets or if he was just saving them for later.
All right, are you guys finished?
One more thing: the nuns. I actually thought they were funny.
No, I meant with the porgs.
We're done with the porgs.
Yeah. All right,
done with the porgs. Love.
Well, I mean, Todd.
I don't want to hear it, Todd. You were bothered less when you saw it with your kids. Let your kids warm your cold.
Oh, my God.
Let the porg flow through you.
All right.
Like
every time they...
The porg's messing with, like, the circuitry of the Falcon and with the glasses on. That was ridiculous, yo. So,
yeah, but Chewie slapped him across the room. He was like, I'm not putting up with this shit.
He took that hard turn, and one of them slapped against the window like a Garfield.
You are Chewbacca, Todd. Like, Chewie eats and physically harms young these cute creatures, and that's, like, that is, like, what you would be if you were in a Star Wars film.
I would.
Chewy was not having it. The thing stowed away clearly, but Chewy was like, "All right, if I had a moment to spare, I would eat this motherfucker." But I've got to fly the Falcon here, and I'm just going to slap this bitch across the room.
It would be awesome if Episode 9 they returned to Endor, and instead of worshiping C-3PO, this time the Ewoks worship the Porgs, so we can get the Ewoks and the Porgs all together at once just for Tom.
Wow. All right. God,
he's driving it home.
Good thing I love you, son. So we will talk about – did anybody have any other favorite funny moments in Last Jedi? Besides Quirks and Poe Dameron pulling Hux's leg.
I don't know if – I guess it was kind of – it was definitely played for laughs. But at the end of the movie, when Kylo is giving orders, there's a scene where he quietly gives an order to do something. I forget what it was. But then Hux comes right behind him and shouts the same order. And Kylo just kind of cuts his eyes at him oh, my God, what's wrong with you? And then there's another part in that same – around that same scene when Hux is telling him not to get – to lose sight of things, to, not go down there and confront Luke. And Kylo just full-on force bitch slaps Hux right up against the wall. And the guy working the controls is like, right away, sir.
Yeah.
That was great timing. Yeah.
I was full-on Daniel Bryan yesing at that point.
Well, that whole sequence, you couldn't believe what you were seeing. And turns out you really couldn't believe what you were seeing with the Luke. And then Luke brushing off that assault off his shoulder was probably my favorite single moment of the film. It was just so well played.
Yeah, it was.
Anybody think there was a bit too much BB-8 in this movie at all for you? Did it bug you at all?
Or no,
BB-8,
no,
BB-8 suddenly being super droid that could do everything?
I'm with
and
Jimmy,
R2-D2... being napping the whole time on the Falcon, waking up for 5 minutes and then being asleep for the rest of the time.
Well, he was, and I guess R2-D2 is also in a coma through all of these movies now because
there we go.
Was awakens.
But the scene he was awake for was awesome. One of my favorite scenes.
Yes, it was. I absolutely loved that
to me too. I could tell that was definitely going to happen.
Yeah.
That was where he was going and going to play the video or play the original holotape. But, I liked some of the BB-8 stuff, but he can fly. He can walk in AT-ST, which was another callback to Return of the Jedi. I liked that. I did like the look that Finn and Rose gave each other when it was revealed that BB-8 was in the cockpit. I did love and Nick called him by his real name BB-9E, which was BB-8's anti/bizarro evil twin Vader BB-8 on
BB Vader.
I thought that was great. That part killed me actually. Just because the whole
that was so weird.
That's actually the hot new Sphero toy this year. Sphero with the app controlled BB-8 was kind of the big craze among Star Wars collectors a couple of years ago. BB-9E, they did a version. They re-released the BB-8 and did a limited edition with the BB-9E paint scheme and a different app, First Order. To control him. So that's basically where that character comes from. He is a soulless marketing ploy, and I have no issue with it.
I don't either.
I have no issue with that, and I kind of hope that we get some kind of fight between those two in Episode 9
down the road. I hope as long as it's done smartly and not just too
not like the Phasma fight.
So
no, yeah, the Phasma fight.
We talked about that earlier, but that fight was much shorter the second time. The first time I was it felt right, and then the second time I saw it, boy, it was over in a hurry.
Ugh, it was awful.
Yep. That whole sequence I know we've harped on about that one already, though. It didn't work for me.
Nick, I know where this is going, so I'm going to let you have it. There were scenes that not everybody liked, and if you could go off on maybe your least favorite scene, the thing that held back the film for you from being absolutely perfect. Because you, if I'm recalling correctly, you gave it maybe a 4 out of 5. If we were going,
I'd go like 4.25 probably.
No halves.
We can't have
whole numbers only.
Whole numbers only. Then I'll go 4. That's fine. Okay. I got no issue with that. The Leia in space thing. One, it is completely. So I'm trying to figure out which level I want to take it apart from. First, from the perspective of Leia specifically, the only thing we had seen, we knew that she was Force adept, but the only thing we had ever seen her actually use the Force to do was to communicate and to have the vaguest sense of premonition. Any kind of active Force use in terms of using it in any real tangible beneficial way, we had never seen that. We didn't see it in Force Awakens. We didn't see it in the original trilogy. We hadn't seen it. So her being able to use the Force to save herself from the cold depths of space and hover back to the ship, that was a bridge too far for me. Like, I'm not someone who was bothered by the depiction of the Force and the Jedi in the prequels. I know some people had criticisms that it essentially turned them into superheroes, whereas in the original trilogy they were more like just extremely skilled warriors with a moral code, more samurai, less superhero. I was never bothered by the expansion of the Force that we saw in the prequel, because it kind of was, to me, showing the Jedi Order at the height of its power. So of course they were going to be able to use the Force to do incredible things that we didn't see in the original trilogy. But here with Leia, we see her do something that no one in the prequel trilogy was able of pulling off. Like, this was, even in a Star Wars movie, it definitely caused me to cease my suspension of disbelief. And that's something that's difficult for me to make me do during a Star Wars movie, because I'm willing to go with you a lot of places. Like, for the most part, I'm willing to go with you on midichlorians. I'm willing to go with you down a lot of roads that most people aren't, but that one, even for me, was just too much. Too much, in my opinion.
I'm going to agree with you on that one.
Me too.
I think that scene could have been better if, like you were alluding to with her premonition abilities, if she had seen the bridge being destroyed in a premonition and then snapped back and just got everybody off the bridge, saving herself for last, and catching like the brunt of, or like the back half of that explosion, and winding up in a coma if they still had to go there. But yeah, that scene, especially on my second viewing of it, really didn't work. And it was the one time in the movie, other than Horse Kitties, that I couldn't get there. It was indeed a bridge too far. The puns.
Also, what a punk way for Akbar to go out.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah, that was terrible. That was the one thing that still bugs me right now, is that Admiral Akbar basically dies off screen. And what a terrible way for such a great character to go.
You know, I love Admiral Akbar as much as the next guy, but that's another example of we as fans just creating these things. Like,
Admiral Akbar,
he's a bit
character.
Like, is a bit character that's been turned into a one joke meme. Like, he gives some orders in Return of the Jedi, and don't get me wrong, I love Return of the Jedi. I've made no secret of the fact it's my favorite Star Wars movie and one of my favorite movies ever, period. But like, this entire cult we created around Admiral Akbar is Boba Fett-esque. Like, the characters who are important are the characters who actually get development and screen time. And you can love the background characters. They're like, they're the spice. They're the salt and pepper that seasons up Star Wars and makes it what it is. But that doesn't mean that every side character is owed some grandiose death.
I would have been less upset.
I'm gonna marry that diatribe. I'm gonna take it behind the bleachers and get it pregnant. Nick.
Welcome.
Okay. So
he's taking it behind the food line.
The food line.
The food line. The sucking hook.
So, but they had to get Akbar out of the way so that Laura Dern / Hillary Clinton could fly the cruiser hyperspace into the Snoke ship.
Right, because they wanted to have her be the second in command. They wanted to, you know, and plus it further drives home the overall thematic thrust of the movie, which is stated multiple times, which is kill it, you know, let the past die, kill it, and on with the new. So you focus on Admiral Akbar too much, and it kind of is not congruent with the rest of what the movie is really saying.
Well, fair enough, but I don't have a problem with them killing Admiral Akbar. Like, if you were going to kill him, okay. And in fact, by a lot of the older characters who I was still not surprised to see a few of them survive at the end of this movie, I don't know the character name, but I just refer to him as Dumpling because he...
Nin Yum.
Oh, yeah, Nin Nub, yeah.
Yeah,
he's still alive after, you know, I mean, he doesn't get much of a part, but if he had died, I wouldn't have had any issue with that whatsoever. But I would make the argument that Admiral Akbar is more important than Boba Fett in the grand scheme of things, and had more to do, certainly, than Boba ever did.
I don't know. That argument is pretty tenuous. I mean, like, in terms of screen time, they're pretty equitable. And Boba Fett kicks off, like, is directly responsible for one of the biggest sequences in Return of the Jedi. The entire opening sequence, like, kind of has Boba Fett as a key element in there.
And then Admiral Akbar has the key,
unless you believe the extended universe, Todd, where he you know,
well,
blasts,
Disney sure doesn't.
Extended universe gone, and we're all the better for it.
Right. Listen, again, let me reiterate. I like Admiral Akbar too. Like, I'm all about Samitsa Trap, and I love the design of the character. And I think the Mon Calamari are one of the most visually distinct races in the Star Wars like pantheon, but. Like, how do you determine which characters need on-screen deaths? Like, if we give Admiral Akbar this moment in this movie, that means, like, 30% of his cinematic screen time in history is devoted to his death. You know, it's not like he had this extensive pantheon before this.
Okay, so Akbar aside, do you think that Leia should have died in the movie?
I there was no right answer. Like, me personally?
Yes.
I would have done it. But I understand why they didn't, because let's draw the parallel to Justice League, where we have this movie that was kind of tinkered with, you know, and we say, man, I wonder what the original plan was. Well, you know, if we had seen the original plan, we would have gone, man, I wonder what the alternate plan was. So, like, if they had changed the movie, people would have gone, oh, I could tell they changed the movie. I wonder what it was going to be. You know, it's kind of like Dark Knight Rises. Like, there's a version of that movie, even if it's not on paper, that exists somewhere in Chris Nolan's head, where Heath Ledger is still alive and has a part to play in that movie. I'm assuming.
And it's this crow's part.
Thank you, Tim. You know, he didn't like. The thing is, if you kill her, it's done after the fact. She doesn't actually get to shoot a death scene, so you've got to put it together in a ham-fisted way anyway. And if you keep her alive, you've got to solve it in a ham-fisted way down the road. So you know what? He probably did. And same thing, in hindsight, this is probably what I would have done. If I knew I wasn't directed 9, fuck it. Somebody else's problem. Keep her alive.
But, so
that sounds right.
My thoughts is that with the time jump that's likely to happen in 9, at least as far as I could tell, I'm betting she dies off screen. And
possibly, oh, shit. But again, that's not Rian Johnson's problem.
I'm saying that there were two schools of thought on what to do with Leia afterwards. There was the, oh, she just rode off into the sunset, and like she's living somewhere on a planet somewhere else because her fight was over, but she's still alive out there. And then there's the school of thought that says, oh, well, she dies off screen, and we just mention it later and show have some kind of memorial service for her. But
you know, one thing I think we need to address here a little bit. I don't know how much you guys have been reading some of the interviews with Rian Johnson, but he talks about excuse me. He talks about some of the more controversial decisions that are made in the film, particularly as it relates to Rey's parents, or as it relates to Snoke, or as it relates to the Leia question of it all. And he actually said something, and you can choose to believe this or not believe this, but this is what he said. He said that when he was approached to do the movie, he was basically given a 99% blank slate by Lucasfilm. They said, this is what's happening in Force Awakens. Here's Force Awakens. What would you view as the extension of that story? How would you tell the next chapter? Kind of what is your reaction to Force Awakens and make that movie? He said there were no, like, you have to do this, 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 and this. So based on what he's saying, the Rey's parentage reveal, it was kind of left up to him to make that the ultimate determination. The decision not to reveal what was going on with Snoke was his decision. The decision to leave Leia alive and kind of have her out there still hanging out was his decision. And so if you follow that through, that means that J.J. Abrams now kind of has the blank slate to work with. Like, he has the option of how do you handle the Leia death. There is no grand plan sketched out, so to speak. I mean, the vaguest sense of one, but not in terms of the finer points already being hashed out. This is not Marvel Studios filmmaking, from what I have been led
to
believe.
No, it's not. I fully believe what Rian Johnson. I have been reading his.
First off, is it Rian or Ryan? We have to agree as a team here. Ryan.
Is it Ryan
Johnson?
It's Ryan,
Mr. Johnson, if you're nasty.
Oh well, Mr. Johnson has said plenty on the subject, and has I've been very much appreciating his openness to talk about the more controversial scenes of the film, and that's also where the whole idea of Captain Phasma possibly coming back later came from. And I did read that quote that Nick is talking about, that he was given basically a 99% blank slate to do as he will. And I think that that's actually been to Star Wars' benefit, that the directors who are coming in basically got to look at what was done just before them and make their sequel to this as they will. And they still have to pitch it, of course, and you know, Lucasfilm still has to get on board with it. But I mean, so far so good. Yeah, if I'm trying to gauge the feeling of the room, I would think that
for
that's
the episodes for the saga. Well, you know, we're talking about the ops. We've had some controversy with the studio taking over and reappointing new directors and reshoots and everything.
Yeah, right. And it's. I mean, with the Han Solo deal, I am curious what that movie looked like before the directors were fired. I'm wondering if it really had as much to do with the story, or if it was just because they didn't get along with Lawrence Kasdan. Which it could go either way. And of all the Star Wars movies that are slated to come out, that's the one that I'm kind of iffy on right now, because
it's coming out in May, and we haven't seen anything.
Yeah, no trailer, no footage, nothing on this movie whatsoever. And I'm like, from what we understand, Ron Howard had to shoot pretty much the entire movie over again.
And it's also starting from a deeply uninteresting premise.
Yeah, if you're not interested in Han Solo's back, any more of Han Solo's backstory than you've already gotten, which I can understand why, then the movie has an uphill battle, and this just adds, you know, a big albatross right around its neck. So, best of luck to it. Hopefully it turns out better than what all this turmoil would lead you to believe it'll be.
As for Johnson,
I'll say on that topic is this very briefly: if there is a debate between anyone on the fucking planet and Lawrence Kasdan on how to handle the character of Han Solo, I know who I'm going to trust, and it's going to be Lawrence Kasdan every fucking time.
Well, absolutely. I'm just, like I said, I don't know. I'd be very curious to know if it's really about that, or if it was a personal thing between the two directors and him just not getting along. And because those types of fights have happened before, and of course Kathleen Kennedy is going to side with Lawrence Kasdan. And why wouldn't she? I mean, these are, Lord and Miller are kind of an unproven commodity in that argument, where Lawrence has more than earned his stripes. So, yeah, I get where her loyalties are going to lie. I'm just wondering, you know, what the full story there is, and if we'll ever find out what it was about. I'm very excited for that tell-all book.
So, let's kind of talk about Episode 9 and what we're looking forward to in Episode 9, and where we're left off after 8. We kind of got a clearing of the table, quite a bit of it. We kind of have a fresh start, although we could get technical and say, well, it wouldn't be that hard for the First Order to track down the Millennium Falcon somewhere, but I digress. We kind of know where that's what they're going, that Johnson left almost a clean table for Abrams for Episode 9. Each of you shoot me some predictions as to what you think is going to happen. Nick, go ahead.
I have no clue whatsoever, other than some sort of course, grandiose conflict between...
Or what you'd like to happen. How about that?
How about Rey and her new little band of Jedis, if the time jump is significant enough to allow for it, up against Kylo Ren and the Knights of Ren, who to this point we have only really seen via flashback, a new Knights of Ren group, kind of an ensemble on ensemble big action scene. That's really the only thing I want from the film, because as we discussed earlier, by kind of combining the Return of the Jedi and Empire Strikes Back formulas in one movie, you kind of now have the potential to do a movie that isn't beholden to a formula, and that is very interesting to me.
Yeah, you're not tied into, well, we have to kind of cross these boxes off. We've checked them off. Force Awakens show that, you know, you can get the audience back by giving them something they're familiar with, but with new faces, but with new twists. And this kind of fulfilled that and finished that out, but left things open for you. All right, so Tim, what do you think?
Much like Nick, I really am just setting my expectations aside. I can't tell you how shocked I am that Johnson was allowed to just upend the mythos and the story structure and the beats that you anticipate in a Star Wars movie as much as he did. I want to see a continuation of that direction, much like Russell described, a sort of physical manifestation of that meta conflict between Rey and Kylo. I want to see that play out. That would be very much up my cul-de-sac, so to speak. I am a little bit worried that after the dust settles on this film, if you know the kind of fandom consensus is so low that Disney/Lucasfilms decides, okay, The Last Jedi was our experimental Star Wars movie. We tried that out. It didn't go over well, so we are never doing that again. So back to basics here. We're going to just, you know, walk everything back, and we're gonna retcon the whole Rey's parents were nobody thing. Like, I cannot think of anything less interesting than Rey's parents are Han and Leia.
Yep.
Rey's parents are Obi-Wan and somebody. Like, I would just, that would be like my Seinfeld GIF moment where I'm just like, fuck this. You know, like it feels like they actually made progress in some direction, in some new direction with this film. And just to abandon that would be like such an admission of defeat to me. So I hope that they continue down this road. I really do.
Yeah, I think so too, and I'm looking forward to it. And we think we all are kind of in agreement that they're going to do a time jump, but we'll see. I think that I wish that Johnson and this template would be seen as universally a success, just as far as let's let this happen for everybody now. Everybody gets to kind of go in places that Star Wars has never gone before thematically and cinematographically. I can't even make that into a word, but he did. And we'll talk about our favorite shots in the film after this. Jenny, what do you think about episode 9, where things are left, what you'd like to see?
Well, as sort of,
owning, I'm assuming.
Yeah. As sort of,
shipping.
Can I finish? Come on now.
We're just helping you start.
I don't hate this movie, but I don't love it the way I usually love Star Wars. But that's not going to deter me in any way from being excited about Episode 9. I'm excited about having JJ back and all of the lens flares. So I'm going to look forward to that. And, you know, we could do the time jump. That's fine. You know, like I said, I kind of do. I wonder where they're going to end up romantically. I want my ships to work out, but I see one that I'm leaning towards probably not. And you know, I want it to be maybe a little bit better dialogue, and a little bit less dead weight.
Interesting. Okay, so by dead weight, can you be a little more specific?
Well, you know, like the scenes that I just didn't care for, like
the horse stuff.
Yeah, you know, that's, you know.
All right, Russell, go for it, my man.
Well, as Tim alluded to, or talked about the physical manifestation, the big fight between Kylo Ren and Rey that's coming up, that has to come up. Like, I want that to wind up being like so fulfilling and emotionally satisfying, and give this whole new trilogy like the ending that it actually truly deserves to have, and one that's worthy of, you know, the Star Wars saga. And I'm hoping that we get to see the true evolution of our main cast, like our new main cast, like Finn and Poe. I want to, especially Finn, I want to see Finn fully realized as a character. I want to see confident Finn, who's now like a leader, or, you know, maybe not necessarily a leader in the new resistance, but maybe he goes off and does his own thing and adopts more of that Han Solo-esque type loner character, you know, one who's always felt like he just wasn't really part of the resistance, even though he technically left the First Order for them. It's like he's, ever since he, you know, joined up with them, he's been trying to leave them. So I'm kind of curious to see what would happen if we explored that idea of Finn being off on his own for a little while, but ultimately coming back Han Solo-esque to be his big hero moment in episode 9, you know, for whatever that's worth. And yeah, the full embracing of the future is what I want to see happen in episode 9. I want them to set themselves up sort of like how this movie did. It set them up for a future movie where all of us are kind of like, we just don't know what's going to happen, and I don't want to get into any kind of fan theories because I feel like I can't really. They've cleared the board of so much stuff that I feel like we're in truly uncharted territory for the first time in a long time, and rather than be afraid of that, I'm just going to embrace it. I'm going to enjoy this unknown, this like complete surprise that's coming for me, because for, you know, finally, one of these big franchise movies has had the ability to completely surprise and shock me in a lot of good ways and some not so good ways. But the point is, it surprised me. It gave me something completely unexpected, and that's what I'm hoping for out of episode 9. Keep that refreshing surprise coming. And I think that a capable filmmaker like J.J. Abrams can come back and fulfill some of the promises that he made in Force Awakens, specifically with a character like Maz, who has yet to tell us the story of how she even got Luke's lightsaber in the first place.
In the tradition of this film, will it matter?
It might not, and it may not. It may. She just said it was a story for another time, and I would be just fine with it if it's like a 5-second, oh, I just happened to be walking along, you know, this aisle in Bespin, and this damn thing hit me in the head. Oh, and there was a hand that fell along with it, which was kind of gross. But that's something I'd be fine with. You know, it's just whatever. I just want to see what they give me. I'm going to go in hoping for a complete surprise. Not going to subscribe. Not going to get myself too buried into fan theories. I hope that would be the lesson of the fandom to take from this. They won't, but I would hope that we'd all take a collective look at this and say, you know, it's nice to think about. It's fun to throw our ideas out there about what may or may not happen, but let's remember, we're not the ones writing these movies. We're not the ones making them or directing them. We're just going to go in and be entertained by them, so go in, keep an open mind, and like, you know, we always have, sit back and enjoy the ride.
All right, before we get going, I want to hear if anybody else had anything else nitpicky or that they didn't get to say about bad things about the film.
I had a nitpick.
Go ahead. Yeah, just go ahead.
Okay, so I loved Luke. I loved everything that Mark Hamill did, except for when she handed him the lightsaber and he tossed it over his shoulder. It was weird. It just seemed off to me. It's nitpicky, but that's how I felt.
Loved it. Big pop.
Yeah, I mean, it kind of set the stage that he's disconnected from the Force and it doesn't matter. Although it was kind of flippant.
Yes,
perhaps
that's what bothered me about it.
I loved everything about it.
So you should have turned and owned it.
That would have been better, or just let it drop on the ground, or just walk by it. I mean, lots of other options.
Fair.
Just it was saying. More of a sight gag than a legitimate.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. It was just weird. It was just weird. It wasn't about what he was trying to say about it. It was just the way he did it. That was weird.
He could have looked at him and, like, there was a hand with that.
Yeah. I mean, something. Anything.
Oh, well, I like that scene.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know if there is anything else that bugged me to the point that I have to say anything. I guess the casino thing was maybe a little too, I don't know what the word is. It didn't feel, it was new, but the music was kind of basic. It wasn't alien enough to me, perhaps. Maybe I thought it was just too what you'd expect a high end planet, high end facility would be in the Star Wars universe. I wanted something maybe like we'd never ever could imagine. Maybe something even more fantastic. Maybe even not crazier.
Not to get off on a tangent,
kind
but
of
did
felt
you
like something out of the prequels?
A bit. Yeah.
In that it was zany. It was kind of madcap. Which okay, fine, but I don't know. It
reminded
was
me a lot of the bar in Episode 2 where they're watching the. The sport, you know, like where they chase the assassin into near the beginning of the movie, and they're watching sports and stuff in there. But again, I am, you know, I can find something to enjoy in practically any instance of Star Wars, Episode 2 included. So
sure, you know. Me too. I just, I don't know. That part was like, again, it's where I felt the length of the movie, and it was, if anything was going to be cut, it was just, this isn't adding anything right
now.
Not
to get too far, not to get off on a tangent, but did anybody else catch the Matthew McConaughey cameo in that scene?
I did not.
No.
He walked directly across in front of the camera as they're doing the sweep of the, they're doing the shot where they're moving through the casino, showing you the casino from the camera's point of view.
Apparently that scene is chock full of cameos.
Yes,
Mark Hamill,
lots of cameos.
Joseph Gordon-Levitt.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Really?
Mm. Yes, Joseph Gordon-Levitt.
The country alien thing that turns them in for parking on the beach is Joseph Gordon-Levitt.
Oh, cool! I didn't know that.
Oh shit! I had no idea.
Yep, my voice performance.
Matthew McConaughey just walks by a straight up Matthew McConaughey though. He looks very much like. He kind of looks like.
That's so weird.
He kind of looks like a very dash, like debonair. He looks like he stepped out of one of those Lincoln commercials and put on a tuxedo.
Maybe that's what he was doing. They're filming it on the next lot, and he just walks over and is like, "Hey, what's going on over here?"
One of those speeders that got fucked up was actually a Lincoln townhouse speeder, town car speeder.
Any other nitpicks? Anyone? Anything else? I have a question. Maybe. What a remarkable coincidence that they ran into another codebreaker in their detention cell.
Yeah.
Was that kind of a setup, or was that actually the guy that they were sent to find
also,
all along?
When did he ever break a code? When did he ever break a code?
He didn't actually break code. He kind of used different means of pulling it off. So that kind of blows up the theory of Maz as like this all-knowing person. Because she didn't know about this dude. I kept waiting for them to reveal he was actually the master code breaker. Then they never did. So,
yeah he just said, I can do this. I can get you into the boudoir. The guy wearing the lapel pin was Justin Theroux.
Yes, I did notice him.
Which I didn't know until I broke it down and saw one of the Easter egg videos. So
that, I mean, to draw the comparison to the Maz Kanata scene, that Maz Kanata scene is where a lot of the cameos in Force Awakens are, and that's kind of where they hit them in this one. So, you know, that's one to go back and kind of look for over, you know, the different celebrities who pop up.
So we haven't talked a lot about the end, the very end of the film, where it's revealed that the heroic rescue of, or at least the appearance of Luke Skywalker to save the day and hold off the First Order is all a ruse, and that Luke is projecting he never left the island, and that last effort to project this energy of him as a physical being who was able to fight with Kylo and touch Leia and do all these things took all the effort out of him and he vaporized. He ascended into the Force. But not until we saw an amazing, beautiful scene of him seeing the twin sons. Were they the twin sons of that island? Were they the twin sons of Tatooine? Or was it just...
Twin sons of that island. But
yeah, that was just a callback.
But a callback to the twin sons of Tatooine.
The same music from episode 4, which is just the first moment of episode 4 that always gives me that yeah. swell in my chest, that chills. That was a great way to go, and just probably my favorite of the things you saw in the film. My favorite cinematography, my favorite use of music, my favorite just scene in general. Just agreed. A great ending to this chapter of Luke's story.
I agree. That was easily the most emotionally affecting moment of the movie for me. And just great. It was great symmetry, and definitely gives the impression that you can look at it, you know, as both an ending and a beginning. Like, you can look at it as the particular end of Luke's journey, and it's all come full circle. And yet, it is a circle, and so this is kind of starting his next journey in the afterlife, and he has part yet to play in things that are to come, as he pretty much outright stated to Kylo Ren with the "see you around, kid" line. So, lots of great, storytelling bits in that scene. I thought it was just one of the more beautiful and subtle moments in the movie. You know, in a movie that at times lacked subtlety.
I loved his line when the line leading up to that "see you around, kid" when he's saying that the rebellion is reborn today and the war is just beginning. So this really does, it speaks to the cyclical nature of the entire Star Wars story. This was just the full passing of the baton, and now we will get a movie where the new cast will have to shoulder everything, and I certainly hope they're up to the task. And I saw some hints in this movie that they are, but it's going to be an interesting episode whenever it comes back. And I felt like we were left in a really good place. Loved that shot of the twin sons, by the way. That was as emotionally affecting. It was pretty close to as emotionally affecting for me as it was for you guys. Though my favorite shot of the movie may have actually been a different one.
I really liked it too. I really liked the close-up on Luke's face. The couple of times when they just did like a real tight shot of him when he's talking to Kylo. It was gorgeous to watch. I did kind of wonder how Kylo didn't realize that was a Force ghost. If he's, you know, more powerful than Snoke, and he, you know, kind of fooled him, then how did he not know that was a Force ghost?
Because Kylo's great flaw is that he is impetuous. Like, he is raw power that is still, like, very much unformed. And Luke is the one thing that causes him to lose all objectivity and lose all sight of any type of strategy or larger goal. Like, he had the entire resistance in his crosshairs and stopped the attack because Luke appeared. Like, that is the one thing that will rattle him and will get him to lash out emotionally, as we see him do in both Force Awakens and the beginning of this film when he destroys his helmet. Like, he is not altogether there emotionally, the way that a cool and calculating villain like the Emperor or Darth Vader were.
Can we all agree that Adam Driver is doing wonderfully?
Yes.
After this one, yes.
He
had his ups and downs in Force Awakens, but this was a much stronger out from him. But a lot of that is, honestly, Rian Johnson wrote him a lot meatier material than J.J. Abrams did, in my opinion. Because outside of the Han Solo death in Force Awakens, he didn't really get a whole lot to do from a character standpoint.
I don't know. That scene with him and Rey was pretty great.
The torture scene?
Yeah.
I just rewatched Force Awakens yesterday, and I actually really liked the moment when he's torturing Poe at the beginning. He seems like very brutal in that particular moment. I mean, it's not the strongest thing in the movie. It's just one that I thought was pretty good. And I also dug in this movie when Snoke told him to take off that ridiculous helmet. And that was the end of the helmet. And I hope that I don't see it making a comeback either. I think we're going to have like, you know, him fully walking around sans helmet for the film or the rest of the, this series.
Sort of like the idea that he's this poser and he's imitating what he thinks this implacable enemy really is, but can't quite back it up. And then in this movie, we see some actual progression and some characterization beyond that, which served him pretty well, that we didn't necessarily get in The Force Awakens design, I think.
I really enjoyed the ESP sessions that he and Rey had. I think that was kind of a bold choice to have them actually be able to have full conversations in each other's head instead of just say calling to each other. Leia, father, this was actual. I'm there with you, and we got tremendous development from both characters in that. Plus, it helped develop the narrative of the whole Luke and Kylo with the three different scenes. So I liked that quite a bit, and you know, gave a different spin how connected he and Rey truly are.
Right.
To me, it's like the universe sees that we've got this chosen one, so to speak, this adept in Kylo Ren, Ben Solo, and so they just kind of the universe creates or is changing the rules of the Force and giving it to a commoner or to somebody unconnected. So it's like to me that life finds a way thing. Yeah. You know, the Force finds a way.
The Force Awakens, if you will. Mm-hmm. Which I mean, that, I'm serious. That was a callback to the name of the film, because one thing that they alluded to in The Force Awakens was an awakening that Snoke mentions, but they don't really follow up on it all that much. But you see it in this movie where, yes, Rey's like abilities have awoken, and she's like naturally tapped to the Force more so than many others. And Snoke called that as something that would eventually happen. But we also see those kids at the end of the film. One of them has Force abilities. He pulls the broom to himself.
That was the very last shot of the film.
Very, very last shot of the movie when it's revealed that that kid is Force sensitive. And in my mind, there are a whole lot of other people who have probably suddenly realized that they're tapped into something that's so much bigger than themselves, and that that kid is also wearing that rebel ring at the end of it. I think is telegraphing where Rian Johnson would like them to go, or at least opening that door to where he could go with the trilogy after this one. So even if we don't see that kid in the next movie, it's not to say we won't see him again later. But I love that. I love that that this movie played on the name of the last one by showing us that, yes, the Force has awoken, and the Jedi are coming back, and that means that not just the light side Jedi, but the dark side will likely be making a big comeback as well. So it opens up all sorts of new doors for them to go through or to bypass. It's just whatever at this point, but I really appreciated getting some kind of true follow-up on the name of the previous movie and making that actually make sense. And it was a bold choice to have this movie start right where the last one left off, which is something a Star Wars movie has never done before.
So this might be one of my nitpicks. It felt like the timeline was a little messy just as far as the Luke and Rey stuff did happen immediately after, but the Rebel pursuit stuff was a little bit later, like a couple months later.
I think it was actually because, you know, when Rey leaves the Rebel base at the end of Force Awakens, we see them like kind of packing up and getting stuff ready to move. And we don't know how long it took her to get to
the evacuation,
to that island. So it's actually one of those things that could have been happening at the exact same time.
Yeah, it felt a little disjointed because that we've never had it in a no gap before in a saga film. Mm-hmm.
yeah, it was a little odd to have like no gap between, like, it just, when Force Awakens ends, you bleed right into The Last Jedi, and they are basically one long movie. Of course, the tone changes quite a bit from one to the other.
Oh boy.
Though I'm one who actually very much appreciated that, while some others probably prefer the JJ take, but that's just whatever. And you know, there's a lot to chew on and to digest in this movie, and I don't think any of us have watched this movie for the last time. I think we're going to be watching it, you know, a few more times. I mean, it might not be our most rewatched Star Wars movie ever, but there's so much in it that it requires multiple viewings, and I think when the next episode comes out, depending on how that goes, it may set The Last Jedi in a new light, much in the same way that The Last Jedi changes up how I view several scenes of The Force Awakens.
Yeah, it's going to be hard to separate them. I think we're just going to keep this trilogy, you know, as its own thing.
Yes.
We'll always talk about the, I don't know if we'll call it the Disney trilogy or the JJ trilogy or whatever. So I think that's it for us. We've taken a pretty good look at The Last Jedi and how we responded to it and how it made us feel and what we think of it. I think we're all pretty positive as far as being a great film, but not the best Star Wars, but still we're going to have to watch it a few more times to see where it really fits in Pantheon. So for Russ Ellers, Nick Duke, Tim Capel, Jennifer Smith, I'm Todd Weber. We will see you next time, and may the Force be with you.
Help me, Obi-Wan.
Her name was Leia. She was a princess with a Danish on each ear and Darth Vader drawing near. So R2-D2 found Ben Kenobi.
Obi-Wan,
he'd have to put the Death Star plans into the Rebellion's hands. So Luke and Obi-Wan had to get to Alderaan. So they stopped into Mos Eisley to have a drink with Han at the Star Wars Cantina. The weirdest creatures you've ever seen. At the Star Wars Cantina. Music and blasters and old Jedi masters at the Star Wars. His name was Solo.
Han Solo.
He was a pilot with a blaster at his side and a smile 12 parsecs wide there with Chewbacca. He was a Wookiee. They met with Luke and Obi-Wan about the Millennium Falcon docking bay 94. Stormtroopers at the door with a flash of Ben's lightsaber. Now there's an arm on the floor at the Star Wars Cantina. The weirdest creatures you've ever seen. At the Star Wars Cantina. Music and blasters and old Jedi masters at the Star Wars.
Mos Eisley Spaceport. You will never find the more wretched hive of scum and villainy. You must be cautious.
His name was Yoda. He was a Muppet. Darth Vader was so bad. And by the way, he's Luke's dad. Luke kissed his sister. His hand got cut off. In that galaxy far, far away, Luke has had a lousy day. Boba Fett was so mean. Jabba had bad hygiene. Why didn't they all just relax back on Tatooine? At the Star Wars Cantina. The weirdest creatures you've ever seen. At the Star Wars Cantina. Music and blasters and old Jedi masters at the Star Wars.
The Force will be with you. Always.